I'm used to the idea of dying, but I have no desire to die for the likes of you.
Gonna rise up and take what's there. 'Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
Startling new numbers out on a growing terrorist watch list in the U.S. USA Today reporting the list now has 1 million entries. That's up 32% since 2007.
This week in radical history for the week starting March 16th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and radical info can be found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
Yo, check this out, man.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This week in radical history for March 16th, 1811, the Luddites attacked machines designed to replace them. The Luddites were a social movement of British textile artisans in the early 19th century who protested, often by destroying mechanized looms, which they felt were leaving them out of work. Since then, however, the term Luddite has been commonly used to describe anyone opposed to technical progress or technical change. Also for March 16, 1933, the last anarcho-syndicalist newspaper, the FAUD, is ordered shut down in Germany. It was started as a union paper for the unemployed in Dresden, in his last journalistic holdout against the Nazi Party. Also on this date in 1965, Alice Herz, an 82-year-old activist, pacifist, immolates herself on a Detroit street corner at the campus of Wayne State University to protest the Vietnam War. Also on this date in 1988 in Iraq, massacre of the Kurds with mustard and nerve gases, which the U.S. and European weapons and chemical companies supplied. Also on this date, 2003, U.S. peace activist Rachel Corrie is killed by the Israeli military.
An Israeli bulldozer killed poor Rachel Corrie as she stood in its path in the township of Rafah. She lost her young life in an act of compassion, trying to protect the poor people of Gaza, whose homes are destroyed by tank shells and bulldozers, and whose plight is exploited by suicide bombers who kill in the name of the people of Gaza. But Rachel Corrie believed in nonviolent resistance, put herself in harm's way as a shield of the people, and paid with her life in a manner most brutal.
Rachel was killed by an Israeli military bulldozer made by Caterpillar Company in the United States while she is participating in a nonviolent movement protesting Israel's illegal 36-year occupation of the Palestinian territories, and specifically trying to save a Palestinian doctor's home from destruction. Eyewitnesses say that Rachel was negotiating with the driver for over 2 hours, was using a blowhorn and wearing a fluorescent orange vest. The driver knew where she was, but ran over anyways.
Rachel Corrie had 23 years. She was born in the town of Olympia, Washington, a skinny, messy, list-making chain smoker who volunteered to protect the Palestinian people who had become non-persons in the eyes of the media, so that people were suffering and no one was seeing.
The following is a short outtake of Rachel in a fifth grade presentation, and also an interview of her right before she's assassinated in Palestine. Rachel Corrie, Presente.
My dream can and will come true if we all look into the future and see the light that shines there. I'm here for other children. I'm here because I care. I'm here because children everywhere are suffering, and because 40,000 people die each day from hunger. I'm here because those people are mostly children. We have got to understand that the poor are all around us and we're ignoring them. We have got to understand that these deaths are preventable. We have got to understand that people in third world countries think and care and smile and cry just like us. But we've got to understand that they are us. We are them.
This is definitely the most difficult situation that I've ever seen. In the time that I've been here, children have been shot and killed. On the 30th of January, the Israeli military bulldozed the two largest water wells, destroying over half of Rafah's water supply. Every few days, if not every day, businesses are demolished here. People are economically devastated because of the closure of the borders into Egypt and the extreme control of the Gazan economy by Israel. I came to look at the aftermath of a place where 25 greenhouses had been demolished on the other side of Rafah, destroying the livelihoods of about 300 people. And that had taken place while they rounded up about 150 men, held them under a sniper tower, and shot around them to contain the men, the farmers in the area. So I feel like what I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive, and that is incredibly horrifying.
And turn Rachel Curry into a non-person. Oh, but you philosophize disgrace, criticize all fears. Bury the rag deep in your face, 'cause now is the time for your tears.
Lastly on Estate in 2006. My name is Rachel Curry. A one-act play due to open this month at New York Theater Workshop was canceled 6 weeks ago under Jewish lobby pressure in New York. This week in Radical History for March 17th, German-American anarchist Johann Most dies in Cincinnati on this date in 1906. Most, perhaps best known for his thoughts and promotion of the idea of propaganda of the deed, which promotes insurrection and perhaps revolution.
This is your Radio News reporter, Crystal Graham. On this day, March 17th, in 1912, American civil rights activist Bayard Rustin was born in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Rustin's political organizing career was very dynamic. Throughout his life, he protested and campaigned against segregation laws, fought an alliance with the Japanese Americans in U.S. internment camps, organized against British rule in India and Africa, and advocated for gay rights. After adopting a strict nonviolent philosophy, Rustin counseled civil rights icon Martin Luther King Jr. and helped form the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, from which he was later forced to resign because he was openly gay. Due to his sexuality, Rustin was largely written out of civil rights history, and his enormous influence was heavily silenced. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
Also on March 17th, more white justice in 1934. Thousands of blacks battled the police in New York to protest the Scottsboro trial. The Scottsboro trial originally were 9 young black defendants, some of them were minors, accused of gang raping 2 fellow hobo white women on a freight train. 8 were quickly convicted in the mob atmosphere at trial. The juries were entirely white, their attorneys had little experience of criminal law, and the judge gave them no time to prepare for their cases. As each case went to the jury, the judge would start the next trial while the previous jury was still deliberating. All but one of these black defendants were sentenced to death on rape convictions. Also March 17th, 2 quick items, 1960. President Eisenhower authorizes secret training of Cuban exiles for an invasion into Cuba. And in 1988, U.S. soldiers are sent to Honduras to protect American interests. This week in Radical History for March 18th. In 1871, the Paris Commune begins. For 2 months, Paris was governed by anarcho-syndicalists, local citizens groups known as communes. These lower middle-class folk, disenfranchised because of the war and the ever-increasing disparity between the bourgeoisie class governing from Versailles and the working folk on the streets of Paris. The German-backed Versailles government forces would eventually overrun the Commune's National Guard units. In all, perhaps 30,000 people died, 50,000 imprisoned or executed, and it was reported that well over 7,000 was sent in exile. The Paris Commune of 1871.
On this day, March 18th, in 1969, during the Vietnam War, the U.S. Air Force initiated Operation Menu, and began bombing Cambodia. Despite Cambodia's official declaration of its neutrality, South Vietnamese liberation troops often used Cambodia as a base. After being warned by the U.S. to ban the South Vietnamese from their soil, the neutral country of Cambodia became the target for this massive secret bombing campaign under President Richard Nixon. Over the next 14 months, the U.S. military showered more bombs on Cambodia than the total amount dropped by the Allies during all of World War II. These brutal bombings were hidden from the American public, but the information eventually leaked out, provoking public outrage in the U.S. And then, the government vowed to never bomb civilians again.
This week in Radical History for March 19, 1935, over 100 injured and $2 million worth of white property destroyed as riots break out in Harlem after a black man's eye is gouged out by policemen. New York City Mayor LaGuardia later refuses to release the study which blamed the violence on the police brutality. Also in New York in 1970, 200 women seized the New York offices of Lady Holmes Journal, demanding that they rename the magazine Women's Liberation Journal. The protest was led by groups like the National Organization of Women, Red Stockings New York Radical Feminist, and Older Women's League.
On this day, March 20th in 1620, the Dutch East India Company was established by a group of Dutch merchants and independent trading companies, marking the beginning of their 21-year monopoly over the spice trade in East Asia. They forcefully colonized any territory they desired and often enslaved the indigenous people. Many countries, like Indonesia and South Africa, are still struggling to recover from the company's oppressive, destructive, and violent legacy.
Also March 20, 2003, Bush and Blair attack Iraq in violation of international law and UN mandates. 24 Tomahawk missiles and four 200,000-pound bunker buster bombs with pinpoint accuracy are fired at Saddam Hussein in a shock and awe attempt to decapitate Iraq leadership. Not one of them hit the intended target. As each, quote, modern war becomes more and more potent, supposedly with more and more accurate targeting abilities, funny isn't how more civilian non-combatants are dying compared to the ratio of combatants. Like this last Gulf War, 1 million Iraqis are dead, double that amount is wounded, and over 4 million displaced. All while the United States casualties only suffered 4,000.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, March 21st in 1617, it is said that Pocahontas died in Gravesend, England. Well, let's take a moment to correct Disney's portrayal of Pocahontas. Her real name was Matoaka, and she was the daughter of a Powhatan chief. She would have been about 10 at the time it is said that she rescued the Englishman John Smith. Pocahontas was later captured, married off to a man named John Rolfe, and transported to England, where she was used as propaganda to support the English colonies in Virginia. She died of disease in England at the age of 21. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also, March 21st, 1907, on Honduras, Marines land during war with Nicaragua to protect U.S. interests, like they did in 1903 and will do again in 1911, 1912, 1919, and 1982. Also, March 21st, 1960, South Africa, Sharpeville massacre of 69 people murdered by police during protest of apartheid laws. Also, on that date, 1965, Viola Liuzu, a civil rights worker from Michigan and mother of four, was murdered while transporting civil rights workers after the Selma to Montgomery march. Four members of the KKK would be arrested. One of them was a paid informant of the FBI. During the trial, she was described as a white nigger. This racial baiting tactic worked, for all four would eventually be found not guilty of her killing. Last in the state in 1985, South Africa again. During her funeral march of the three killed in Sharpsville Memorial Demo, South African police killed 19 more innocent people. This week in Radical History for March 22nd, I only have a couple items. 1905 in France, the trial of Alexandre Jacob and his gang began on March 8th, concludes in a guilty verdict. Jacob was a burglar member of the Anarchist Workers of the Night gang, credited with 150 burglaries. The gang was formed with his companion Rose Roux, his mother Marie Berthieu, and others. For 3 years during their spree, they methodically planned their jobs based on railroad networks and schedules, targeting rich people's homes, hotels, castles, and churches. not for personal gain, but with the intent to attack the powerful and rich while creating a forum for disruption of the social world. He'd receive life imprisonment and other members between 5 and 20 years. Lastly, in 1972, Congress approves the Equal Rights Amendment, the ERA, which has not ratified enough states to ever become constitutional federal law.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features a Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. Ilan Pappe, the Israeli historian, has written a new book, The Biggest Prison on Earth, A History of the Occupied Territories. It is an important follow-up to his seminal work, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. He concluded his current U.S. book tour with a presentation to a packed house in Cambridge, and that discussion will constitute our total program this morning, which was introduced and moderated by UMass Boston professor Leila Farsak. We begin with Leila's introduction.
It gives me great pleasure to see all of you today, and of course a great honor to be presenting Professor Ilan Pappe, who doesn't need much introduction, but we still have to do an introduction. And I think the introduction I would like to give is just, I think Professor Ilan Pappe is one of the most courageous and important historian of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Courageous because he is not scared of speaking truth to power and to dig Zionist and Israeli files to prove and revalidate what Palestinian and what many people did not know about what is the essence of Zionism and why this conflict has been going on for so long. But also because he's very keen on not just digging history for the sake of history, but digging history in order to know what to understand from it, what to learn from it, and what to do with it. So what to do with history is as important for Ilan Pappe as much as what we learn from history. And in that respect, he would be what many in the United States would call a public intellectual. I do not like very much this term, public intellectual. Basically, somebody who thinks and puts his thinking into action, which should be the function of any intellectual, just as any activist should also think before being activist. So it's just important that he doesn't sort of separate academia from politics and understand that every knowledge we have is a form of power, and it's a question of what we do with this knowledge. Do we keep it for ourselves? Do we keep it for advancing certain myopic interests, or do we use it for a greater good, which is basically our humanity and inequality? So I please join me in welcoming Professor Ilan Pappe. He's a student of the university.
Thank you, Leila, for your kind introduction. And thank you, Nancy, for being so steadfast and making sure that people like me cannot escape on the way to Logan Airport without paying their due respect to this wonderful audience here tonight. It's a great pleasure to talk to you about my new book, The Biggest Prison. The topic itself, of course, doesn't bring me any pleasure, but I hope that it contributes to our knowledge, and as Leila rightly said, also to what we can do with that knowledge in order to help strengthen the movement of solidarity with the Palestinian people and hopefully also have an impact on the events on the ground itself. I've been doing these public talks for 35 years, and I do realize that the pendulum has shifted in the public opinion, including in this country. The BDS movement is just one manifestation of how different is the solidarity movement with Palestine today compared to when I started in the early 1980s. And yet, there is this gap between the shift in public opinion on the one hand and the reality on the ground that doesn't change. If anything, gets worse. So we're missing something in the way that we do things, probably. And maybe this will be also some topic for discussion, because I will only talk for half an hour and leave some time for discussion.
It's hard to hear.
It's hard to hear? Okay. Yes. I will talk closer to... Is this better?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. So you mean you haven't heard the word I said? That's worrying. Because I cannot repeat what I said. I don't know. No idea what I said. Anyway, I hope it was okay. The idea for the book came, first of all, as Nancy said, as a way of continuing the book I wrote in 2007, which more or less ended in 1949, and I wanted to see the continuation of the same, or analyze the continuation of the same policies and ideologies and strategies of the Zionist movement after the ethnic cleansing of 1948. But there were other reasons for writing this book. The historical narrative that informs the peace process, the so-called peace process, has a very clear perception of the year 1967, first of all, as a watershed, a very important year, almost like a year in which everything went wrong. That's when the conflict started, that's when Israel became a state that violates human rights and civil rights. That's the historical moment where things in Palestine were deteriorating. And I wanted to challenge, first of all, this particular historical perspective by contextualizing the events of 1967 within a broader historical analysis. Secondly, there is a common narrative about 1967 that many historians accept, which I also wanted to challenge. This sort of clear story of an intransigent and aggressive Arab world that tries in 1967 to destroy the Jewish state. The Jewish state defends itself and has no choice but to occupy the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, the Golan Heights, and the Sinai Peninsula as a war of defense, a war of no choice. And even very critical scholars and intellectuals who write about Israel in a way that definitely attracts our attention would say that 67 was a war of no choice and Israel had no alternative. And I wanted to challenge that as well. And lastly, I wanted to show that the so-called peace process is actually part of the Israeli way of controlling the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. That the peace process is not an independent attempt from the outside to bring about reconciliation and peace, but it's rather one of the tactics used by Israel in order to fulfill the objectives of the Zionist project that can go back to the late 19th century. And one of the reasons I waited with the book was that I was looking for a clear paradigm to put all these objectives together, the wish to reassess the peace process, the 1967 war itself, and the so-called Israeli occupation. And luckily, as maybe quite a few of you know, recently the academic community that writes about Palestine, researches Palestine, came up with with an old new paradigm, which is very helpful and very useful, viewing the Zionist movement as a settler colonialist movement, distinguishing between colonialism, if you want classical colonialism, and settler colonialism. The United States, of course, is a settler colonialist society as well. And what is important about settler colonialism is that it contextualized the case study of Palestine in a wider global kind of framework, which is important. I think none of us wants to look at Palestine all the time as an exceptional historical case study. I think actually normalizing the situation in Palestine, contextualizing it in a wider global context, is something which would benefit, I think, both the academic research on Palestine, but also the activism on behalf of Palestine. And settler colonialism that says, you know, Palestine is not the only place that was affected by fugitives or refugees from Europe looking for a new home, in fact looking for a new homeland because they were persecuted in the continent. This happened before Palestine and happened after Palestine. This whole idea that settlers, first of all, are victims themselves of a persecution, and secondly, that they choose a place where already someone else lives. And the main obstacle for them to save themselves, and the main obstacle for them to define themselves as a new nation, is the presence of the natives. And as the late Patrick Wolfe used to say, at this particular moment, the logic of the annihilation of the native suddenly pops up and emerges. And in this country, the elimination of the native was a physical elimination of the native, the genocide of the Native Americans. In South Africa and Palestine, there were other things that happened to the natives, maybe not as bad as genocide, but also quite atrocious, such as ethnic cleansing, apartheid, and other actions that today would be defined as crimes against humanity. So this paradigm, looking at Zionism as a settler colonial movement, helped me to locate the Zionist movement in its early stages on Palestine, together with the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948, and the Israeli actions, and also explained and contextualized within the same paradigms the Israeli actions in 1967 and after 1967. In fact, the Palestinians, for many, many years, without using the term settler colonialism, were using another term which in many ways reflects the same idea of settler colonialism. And this is al-Nakba al-Mustamirra, the ongoing Nakba. The same late Patrick Wood, whom I mentioned, who was an Australian scholar that unfortunately died 2 years ago and wrote extensively on settler colonialism, said that settler colonialism is not an event, it's a structure. And it's exactly what we see with Zionism. And when you talk about settler colonialism as a structure, it means that the same ideology, the same impulse that leads the Zionist movement to buy land in the 1920s and kick out the tenants who work on that land and to transfer the Palestinians by force in 1948 and to occupy the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in 1967, the same impulses work in all these historical junctions because the ideological structure of Zionism has not changed. And it is still with us in 2018. And what is fascinating is how this project, which dehumanizes the native, the indigenous Palestinian, was commodified and sold to the world as something else, as a project of democracy, in fact, the only democracy in the Middle East, as a project of human rights and civil rights that are under attack, as a temporary a project of oppression because of the aggression of the other side, an oppression that would end once peace would be implemented just around the corner. And the whole paradigm of two-state solution fitted very well this kind of propaganda that took the basic idea of settler colonialism, which is to turn the settlers into indigenous and get rid of the indigenous population, turned it into something else in the eyes of the world. It's kind of a conflict between two national movements with the same rights to the land, kind of a paradigm of parity, and what you needed was an international interference, kind of a mature grown-up, which surprisingly was supposed to be the United States, a mature grown-up that was supposed to help these less developed societies to reach reconciliation and peace. So this is a conceptual framework of the book. I will come back to the metaphor of the big prison, which is in the title, which for me is very important, in a moment. I just want to say that on the way to analyzing the events of 1967 and the Israeli policy towards the occupation, in the early years of the occupation after the 67 war ended, on the way to it, I also came across few pieces of evidence that also shed a different light on what happened in the war of 67. I didn't mean to do this, but while I was doing it, I found out something that was really intriguing. The whole idea of settler colonialism is that in the modern time, especially after the Second World War, you cannot use the same methodology against the indigenous people that you could use in the 19th century or the 18th century. There's a certain international sensitivity after the Second World War, especially, of course, in the case of a state that claims to represent the victims of the ultimate crime of the 20th century, the Holocaust, the Jews. And therefore, the settler colonialist project has to be far more clever and sophisticated. There's no easy access to the same methodology white settler used in the United States or in Australia or New Zealand. It has to be far more adapted to the realities after the Second World War. And one of the things that I noticed was that one of the major means after the ethnic cleansing of Palestine for continuing the basic project of settler colonialism, namely to get rid of the indigenous population and turn the settlers into indigenous. The main means between 1948 to 1967 was, or the main problem rather, between 48 and 1967, for the Jewish state that was created over 80% of Palestine, and they kicked out almost 80% of the Palestinians who used to live in what became Israel. The main problem was the remaining 20% Palestinians, what we call today, the Israelis call today, the Arab Israelis or the Israeli Arabs. That is the Palestinian minority inside Israel. And from a settler colonialist perspective, you understand that the main kind of method that Israel used was the military rule. And probably you are familiar with the military rule because it's the same military rule that would be imposed later on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Based on British mandatory emergency regulation, it gives the army total and absolute control in the life of people. So a sergeant in the army can become a king in the little kingdom, which could be a Palestinian village, a Palestinian neighborhood. They have the right to do whatever they want, actually, with the Palestinian population. The Israeli variation, I suppose, was a bit more sophisticated because the same Palestinians who were at the mercy of Israeli soldiers between 48 and 1967 were allowed to vote and were allowed to be elected to the Israeli parliament. So this created kind of confusion from the outside. They said, well, this is a democracy because Arabs can go and vote and be elected. And yet this democracy was futile by the fact that a soldier could have decided to close your shop to prevent you from going to school, demolish your house, or exile you either inside Israel or, as they did to some people, outside Israel. And of course, there is no legal system. The army is both the legislative, executive, and juristic authority on the land. Now, what I learned on the way to 1967, that there were a lot of people inside Israel who felt uncomfortable with this kind of imposition of military law on Palestinians inside Israel. So what they did, they looked for a way of getting rid of that mechanism. And the main person who rejected the idea of abolishing the military rule was David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel. But he stopped being a political figure of importance in 1963. So I asked myself, if in 1963 he was removed from politics and he was the main obstacle to remove the military rule, why the military rule continued until 1967? And then I came across the answer, by mistake. It was not the main purpose of the book, but it was became an important part of the book. And that is, in 1963, the government that replaced David Ben-Gurion said, wait a minute, we might need this military rule for another Palestinian group. And that's when I learned that in 1963, there were systematic and very intensive preparation in Israel for the eventuality of the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The whole idea was to transmit the military rule inside Israel that many Israelis felt was not necessary anymore and impose it on another Palestinian group, those who live in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. But this was 4 years before the actual occupation. So it sort of casts a different light on the way the crisis developed in 1967. Because those of you who are familiar with the history of the June 67 war know that in almost every moment in that war, despite of the policy of Jamal Abdel Nasser, the leader of Egypt, and the Syrians and the Russian involvement in it, there were a lot of exit points. There was a lot of moments where you could have stopped that war. And of course, when you look at the Israeli documents, you realize there was no wish in Israel to stop the war. On the contrary, the war was looked as a golden opportunity to complete the work of 1967. And ironically, the architect of the ethnic cleansing of 1948, David Ben-Gurion, was the one who opposed all through the years the occupation of the West Bank, because he said, we will lose our demographic absolute demographic majority if we annex the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. He said, we kicked all these people to the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Why would we want to incorporate them after we got rid of them? Now, once he was out of power, there was, and Tom Segev actually wrote about it before me a little bit in his book 1967, the Israeli journalist, there was a greater Israel lobby in the 60s. Generals from 48 who pushed the government not to seek every possible opportunity to extend the space of Israel and to occupy the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and the opportunity landed itself in 1967. So that is one part of the book. And of course there's more details in the book how this, kind of a new history if you want, of 67 has to be further explored. I didn't do all the work needed to be done because, as I said, this was less the focus of what I was looking at, but I couldn't sort of resist on the way. The main thing was the metaphor of the prison that reflects to my mind the Israeli strategy towards the Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, which has not changed since 1967 until today. And for that policy, I use the metaphor of a prison. Now, it's not the best metaphor, but it's the best I had, because sometimes this is a prison from which people don't want to escape. Sometimes it is a prison to which people want to enter. But I didn't mean it in that way. I meant that the mentality of the Israelis, when they perceived this area, was the mentality of a warden in a prison. So it's not a complete metaphor. One can find, of course, holes in that metaphor. I just pointed out to them. But it was much more the Israeli, it's kind of a translation of the Israeli strategy towards the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in metaphoric terms. So this is what led to it. And what was very important for me was to understand that actually Israel took three strategic decisions in June 1967, immediately after they occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, based on the preparation I just mentioned in 1963, that they took three decisions that informed all the policies of the successive Israeli government since June 67, and also fed the so-called peace process in many, many ways. And this is important to understand. It gives you a better explanation, and also forensic view on the Israeli settler colonialist project that I think we didn't have before. Now, the three decisions, before I talk about the three decisions that the Israelis took, I want to mention that the government of Israel in June 67, the government that took these decisions, was a very unique government. It was the most consensual government we ever had in Israel before and after. It was a government that included every political party in the Israeli system. It never happened before, and never, probably will never happen again. So they rightly felt that they represented fully the Jewish community in Israel. And that gives you a lot of strength if you think that you are the most, almost like a parliament, more than a government. Secondly, what was unique about that government was that half of the ministers were former generals in 1948 responsible for the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. So they were there as well making the decision. And what were the three decisions, which are very important, and I think they're still with us. The first decision was that Israel cannot exist without the West Bank. That the West Bank, either for strategic reasons or for ideological reasons, has always to be part of Israel. There was a serious debate in the Israeli society, there was a serious debate later on among Israeli strategies. What is the best way of doing it? Does this require annexation? Does this require a Palestinian collaboration? Does this require an agreement with Jordan? All kinds of possibilities. But what they all had in common was that this was the heart of the land, and the body would die without the heart of the land. So people who claimed that strategically Israel could not survive without the West Bank allied themselves to people who had a more religious messianic view, saying this is the heart of the ancient land. And in many ways, the peace process was born there. The peace process was, how do you sell an idea which probably the international community would not accept, that Israel has the right to maintain the West Bank? How can you sell it in a way that the international community would not rebuke you for actually taking by force something that, according to the international law, did not belong to you? And the peace process was an excellent exercise in keeping saying that, you know, it's a temporary reality, and of course, if there would be a partner to talk to, then Israel might withdraw from the West Bank. And we saw, and I don't have to tell you, the book of course covers it, but this is a known territory. Israel usually got rid of the people it could talk to and preferred the people it could not talk to. And when there was finally an agreement, the Oslo Accord in 1993, the Israeli interpretation of the agreement, if you look at the Israeli interpretation of the Oslo Accord, you understand that this is an idea of how to keep the West Bank through the subcontracting of their security to a Palestinian agency, and how keeping the control from the outside, from the air and from the sea, in a way that defeated any notion of independence or self-determination for the Palestinians, either in the West Bank or in the Gaza Strip. But it's very clear to me that this idea was clearly conceived in 1967, and it was very interesting also to read the American documents, because the American State Department at that time was far less hostile to the Palestinians than it is today. And there were quite clever people there who understood what Israel was doing, but they couldn't convince the politicians that actually this is a charade. Because it was, you know, all the, I don't have to go into it, because we all know how the place of Israel is being maintained in the American public opinion through the work of the lobby, Christian Zionists, and so on. So it was not enough that you had a group of quite decent American experts in the State Department who saw Israel for what it was. They said there's no way that the Israelis are going to get rid of the West Bank. They were very they predicted the next 50 years precisely, one should say, very interestingly. A very interesting material by itself. So this is the first decision. The first decision is, and every settler colonial movement wants space, more and more space, and it doesn't want the indigenous population in it. So settler colonialism is always this balance between demography and geography, population and space. The more space you have more problem because there's more demography that you don't want. So you need to find the balance for taking more territory and finding a way of downsizing the population you don't want. So the space, it was very clear to everyone. This was an essential expansion of the borders of Israel to make it a viable state. Remember, Israel only existed 19 years in 67, and there was a sense that, as Abba Ivan used to call it, that Israel lives within what he called the Auschwitz borders, namely the pre-June 67 borders. So if you want to find an alternative to Auschwitz, you need to keep the West Bank as part of Israel. The Gaza Strip, as always, was a bit more complicated, but I don't have time to go into it, but we might go into it in the discussion. Now, the second decision was, if you want, the second question was, what to do with the population? Okay, so are we going to expel them the way we expelled them in 1948? And some, as I said, half of the ministers were generals who knew something about ethnic cleansing, and they took part in it in 1948. But the general consensus was that you could not repeat the ethnic cleansing of 48 in 1967. That doesn't mean that hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were not expelled immediately after the 67 war from the old city in Jerusalem, from the three refugee camps near Jericho. But basically, the idea of massive cleansing was ruled out. So here comes the third decision. If you keep the territory and you don't expel the people, what would be the status of the people? And they had a very serious debate about it. And it seemed that there was a consensus whether you were a liberal or a socialist, whether you were a soft Zionist or hardcore Zionist. There was one consensus. We cannot grant these people citizenship. Because if we grant the millions of Palestinians citizenship, the whole idea of a Jewish state goes out of the window. So someone, actually Menachem Begin, who was part of the government, asked the Minister of Defense, Moshe Dayan, so if we don't annex the territories and we don't give them citizenship, what would be their status? And Moshe Dayan says very clearly, he says, there will be citizenless citizens without the rights of citizens, which means they could work, they could prosper, he said, they could have connection to Jordan, but they cannot be, will never enjoy the rights. And Begin asked him, for how long do you think people can live under such a condition? And Dayan, eeringly said, oh, at least for 50 years. And we are now in the 50 years, or 51 years after that declaration. And I think it's very important to, and this is where the metaphor of the big prison comes. Because this is the consensus. We keep the territory, we don't expel the people, but we don't grant them citizenship. So we need to maintain them, and this is the moment when the Israelis realize that they will police for a very long time, millions of people. And they're not daunted by this perspective. They say, okay, if this is what we have to do, as the late Israeli philosopher Yeshayahu Leibowitz said, they became a Shabak state, that is a Muhabarat state or secret service state. They said, okay, this is the role of Israel, is to police these people so that the space can be kept and the demography cannot threaten you. And we have now a third generation of people who maintain this policing. And they developed these two models of prisons, and this is my word. They didn't use the word prison. I don't want to mislead anyone. And with this, I would strive to conclusion. They said, if the people of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip accept the idea of the Israeli strategy, which included, as I describe in the book, colonization, Judaization, Jewish settlements, military bases, everything you need to control millions of people. You can't just send police on the beat. to control. You needed a real structure. So if they accept it, they live in a kind of an open prison. Namely, they can work outside, they can have some sort of autonomy. But of course, everything depends, as it does after the Oslo Accord as well, depends on the goodwill of the warden. But if you behave well, you can have as much autonomy as we can allow you. And that's the open prison model. However, if you resist, and the Palestinians resisted in 69, and they resisted in 87, and they resisted in 2000, and in the Gaza Strip for several years since 2009, then the maximum security kind of prison comes into effect, which is collective punishment, denial of the basic rights, and this is a kind of a game that the Israelis are playing. You accept our strategy and perceptions, you live in kind of an open prison. You don't, you're being punished with a model of a punitive kind of maximum prison. Now, of course, with years, both models are being modified and adapted to the reality. The open prison becomes the idea that Leila has written a lot about, the Israeli version of Bantustan. That, for me, is an open prison. And this is the one that is being sold through the process, the Oslo process and everything that comes with the so-called discourse of peace. And then there is the new variant of the maximum security prison in the Gaza Strip, which is far more than a maximum security prison. It's a ghetto that is being punished from the outside with all the military might that Israel has. And I would end by saying there's nothing that happened in the international community at the level of the political elites. And there's nothing that the Palestinian liberation movement has succeeded of doing so far on the ground. And definitely there's nothing that has changed in the basic politics inside Israel that forces the Israelis to change this strategy and perception. The open prison is what the Israeli left still believes in and really thinks that this is a big concession. And this shows the humanity and the universal values of the Israeli society. The maximum security is more easily offered by the right wing in Israel because there is kind of a disbelief that the Palestinians would ever agree to anything that Israel offers. So potentially every Palestinian is a terrorist in that respect. But the end result is the same in the last 50 years. Palestinians are incarcerated in a human model that the only thing that I could come up with that reminded me of what Israel is doing is a prison. But the only crime that they have committed is for being a Palestinian. And they are being incarcerated because of that. And I will finish by saying that the whole peace process gave international justification for this Israeli policy for two reasons. One is they really bought into this Israeli argument that this is all temporary. That unfortunately we have to do it, but, you know, when peace will come, we will of course dismantle all these structures. And but unfortunately it's the Palestinian fault, and therefore the structures have to be maintained. And too many good people in the world have bought into this. And secondly, since the so-called war on terror, Israel is now the big exporter of securitization. As if their experience from running millions of people within a structure that is a prison structure is something that can advise Western government in the so-called war against terror. And I will end by quoting, just to give you a flavor of this securitization export industry of Israel, and so that we know what we are facing, by quoting the Israeli Minister of Transport, who came to Belgium a few days after a terrorist attack in Brussels airport and underground. And he said on Belgian television, he said, "You know, you really need us, the Israelis." And the interviewer asked him why. He said, you hardly know how to deal with 50, 60 terrorists. Look what happens. We have millions of terrorists, and we know how to deal with them. And this is the kind of message that Israel has successfully, unfortunately, in certain sections, conveyed. I don't want to end on totally pessimistic. No, I think that if we will change the language, if we will frame first in the academia, in the media, in the public community, if we will frame the Israeli actions in the West Bank and the Gulf Strip as settler colonialism and colonialism and colonization, not occupation, colonization. And if we will connect it to what happened to the Palestinians in 1948, and we will talk about decolonization and not peace, we will talk about change of regime and not two-state solution, then I think we can start at least portraying the reality on the ground for what it is, and then hopefully convince enough people that we have the human capacity, for the sake of Jews and Palestinians, to build a different political reality in which the Palestinians would be liberated in the full sense of the word. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this very insightful and I'm sure thought-provoking book, which we really need to read. I mean, I don't want to take away from what people want to ask, but I think there are two issues that I would like you to address before I open it to everybody, because I think you highlighted very neatly how the occupation is a continuation of Zionism. It is not a rupture. And it is true when we deal a lot with Israeli historians or politicians, there is some tendency, especially among the left, to say, well, it was a mistake, it was not meant to be like this. You know, of course, there are people who are pushing for it, but the right solution to save Israel is a two-state solution. So you are offering, you're showing or you're arguing in your book that this is not the case, that it is not a watershed moment, it's a continuation, it's a process, not just a structure, it's a process that continues. But as you know, it's also a function of the powers game at the time. Now, the big question from the three elements that you've highlighted, which are very important, what do we do with the people, what do we do with the geography, and what do we do with the rights of the people? And basically say, with the rights of the people, the decision was, we decide what rights we give them, okay, they are non-citizens, okay, or non-citizen subjects. But they have some rights, which are human rights, and people wrote a lot about the human rights of Palestinians inside the West Bank as different from those in 48. When it comes to the second point you said is, what do we do with the population, is we cannot do ethnic cleansing. Okay, that was also decided. But the issue I'm having problem with is how far your argument is that we cannot give the West Bank. Because how do you tackle the issue of the Alon plan? The Alon plan was a central plan of Israel. It never was an official document, but everybody knows about it, which was the terms that the Israeli establishment, this unity government, which was very important, agreed more or less on what is that they cannot give up in the West Bank. And the argument was, as far as I understood it, is that the territories were subject to negotiation. I mean, from all what Israel won in 67, the big chunks that got the Sinai, West Bank, Gaza, Golan Heights, these were going to be bargaining chips. But with regards to the West Bank and Gaza in particular, the West Bank in particular, it was clear Jerusalem is to be annexed, and this is exactly is there. But how much land of the West Bank, it was a debate of 25 to 40% of the West Bank. And I think the reason why 40% to 25% of the West Bank was precisely to get rid of the democracy, because not most of them, most of the Palestinians did not leave in 48. So it's 67. So how do you settle this reality? I mean, because it's true, after 50 years, what we realize, the Palestinians are living on 50 to 60% of the West Bank. But this commitment to annexing the West Bank de facto, if not de jure, how far do you combine this with the long term? And also the point of intentionality, because one of the biggest problems in any politics is how far do we say this was really intentional, like this in 1967. The fact that Zionism is a settler colonial project we can all agree upon. I mean, also Israeli agree upon it. And that any project, any state project, it wants to expand. But there is the issue of the counterfactual, there's the issue of the resistance that limits the tactics. Zionism also evolved. So just to handle that issue, just because it can help counter argument of saying, oh, well, you think all of them are just hate Arabs, you know, and just show that there is, how can we counter such an argument?
Yeah.
And then I'll take questions.
Okay.
If you prefer that you sit, to sit down.
No, I don't mind.
You might have some questions.
That's okay. Yes, two very, very good points, and of course I didn't have time to go on into them. They are in the book. I think that what I tried to say, and maybe I didn't say it clear enough, that the debate inside Israel was, even in the 67 government, was between those who said, how do we rule them directly and how do we rule them indirectly? So the Alon plan, first of all, mapped the areas which we have to rule directly. And it didn't mean that the areas that are not ruled indirectly are not part of the scheme. Now, Alon, as you probably know, he had two versions. He said the indirect areas, and this reminds us of Oslo. At first he thought maybe we will allow the Jordanians, or we will share with the Jordanians control over those areas. And then he said maybe it's much better to have Palestinian autonomy in those areas. But we have to decipher what the Israelis mean. Now we know better, but even then we understood it. What they mean by Palestinian autonomy.
Right.
They mean by Palestinian autonomy, it's exactly where the open prison model comes into it. You're autonomous in the open prison, in many ways, apart from the parameters around you. And I think this is what I meant in this respect. Of course, what complicated for the Israelis the situation was that Alon had a very clear strategic map. He said, we will transfer, or we will bring Jews from Israel into the West Bank and the Gaza Strip into places which are not densely populated by Palestinians. But then, alongside the official Israeli government, a messianic movement emerged, Gush Emunim, who had their own map. And it was exactly the opposite map of the government. They took the Bible as a map. And with the help of archaeologists, determined that they want to colonize and Judaize the areas where they believed were biblical sites. Now, all these biblical sites were in the midst of densely populated Palestinian area. So when in 77, the government that is closed ideologically to this messianic movement comes to power, the two maps fuse together, and therefore the 25 or 30% of Alon for direct rule becomes 60% of direct rule, and 40% was supposed to be autonomous long before Oslo, even at the time of the Sadat initiative and so on.
You have been listening to Israeli historian Ilan Pappe discussing his new book, The Biggest Prison on Earth, A History of the Occupied Territories.
.3 KPFB in Berkeley and 88.1 KFCF in Fresno.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, jobs, debts, incomes, those we face, those coming down the road, and those confronting our children and the next generation. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, with the hope that I can bring to bear what I've learned to make more sense out of the surrounding economic events than the most major media seem able to do. So let's jump right in. One of the most important documents of the last few weeks was a paper a pamphlet actually, issued by Oxfam International. Oxfam is the most widely used and respected institution based in Great Britain that studies global inequality, has been doing it for years. In January of 2018, they issued a document entitled Reward Work, Not Wealth. Basically, it makes the case for exactly what its title says. But in so doing, it talks about the latest research it has either done or commissioned on global inequality, including the attitudes of people toward global inequality. So I want to bring you some of what they found, because it is crucial to understanding how the capitalist system that governs the world today, both in the so-called advanced part of the world and in the so-called less developed part. If you want to make an assessment of the capitalist system, take a look at its results. It's a logical way to proceed. So here are some of them. Last year, that's 2017, saw the biggest increase in the number of billionaires in history. One more billionaire was added to the list every 2 days. There are now, and this may come as a surprise to you, 2,043 billionaires in the world. 9 out of 10 of them are men. These billionaires, these 2,043 individuals, in a population on this planet of 7 billion individuals, 2,000, that's 0.00001% of the population, their wealth last year increased by a total of $762 billion. That is, the value of their stocks and bonds and land holdings went up by $762 billion. By every known calculation of the number of people around the world living in extreme poverty, that amount of money is more than you need to eradicate extreme poverty on this planet. Let me drive this point home to you. The richest 2,043 people on the earth became richer over the last year by an amount of money larger than what would have been necessary to bring hundreds of millions of people out of extreme poverty, usually calculated as people living on less than $1.90 per day for food, clothing, shelter, and everything else. What kind of a society would be organized in such a way as to make the 2,043 richest people on the planet $762 billion richer, when that's more than the money needed to eradicate extreme poverty for their fellow citizens, for their fellow human beings? This is a system that can't solve that problem, that makes the problem worse year after year. Meanwhile, some statistics I've given you in the past continue to be true and reaffirmed by Oxfam's research. The richest 1% on this planet own more wealth than the other 99% combined. The richest 1%, this happened in 2016, went over half. That is, the richest 1% own more than half. The other 99% fight over the remaining half. What Oxfam also did last year, and what I also want to report to you, is they interviewed, they surveyed 70,000 people in 10 countries. Population of those countries represent 1/4 of the world's population. So they did this survey in countries that together account for 1/4 of the people on this planet. Over three-quarters of the people they surveyed either agree or strongly agree that the gap between rich and poor in their country is too large. The numbers range from 58% in the Netherlands, believe that, to 92% in Nigeria, believe that. Two-thirds of the respondents in the 10 countries think that the gap between rich and poor needs to be addressed urgently or very urgently. So what have we got? A wildly unequal distribution of wealth and income in the world, and a vast majority of the people who are against it. And nonetheless, it gets worse, not better, with each passing year. What the majority thinks is unable in this culture and in this economy to be translated into corrective action. Overwhelming majorities want something which doesn't happen. The opposite happens, which means that those at the top not only have the wealth in their hands, but have bought the political system to make sure it isn't responsive to what the majority of people would want. This means that the consequences of capitalism are not only gross inequality, but also the political corruption that prevents that problem from being addressed, even though the majority of people want it to be. In a peculiar way, much of the rest of today's economic updates will operate a little bit to illustrate what the summary that Oxfam has produced allowed me to just tell you about. So let's begin. Let me introduce to you the owner of a store you may have encountered, if not personally, well, through the internet. The store in question is called Victoria's Secret. It is a famous store that sells lingerie and all kinds of underwear and so forth. The owner is a billionaire, one of the 2043 I just told you about. His name is Leslie Wexner, W-E-X-N-E-R. He is 78 years of age, and he is worth, apparently, $7 billion. That is, he owns $7 billion worth of, well, I'm going to tell you about some of the things he owns, but I presume most of it is stocks and bonds, because that's what most of the wealthy hold most of their wealth in, those forms. But Mr. Wexner lives well. Perhaps most famous is a huge mansion in Britain. Mansions in Britain have their own name. This one is called Foxcote, F-O-X-C-O-T-E. Cost him apparently $30 million. It is referred to in the press as a gentleman's shooting estate. In October, helicopters came in, and apparently the shooting was done from the helicopter. What kind of sport you might want to call this, I leave to your judgment and your imagination. Mr. Wexner also owns a $47 million mansion outside of Columbus, Ohio. Likewise, one of the largest yachts ever built in the world, he owns it. In 1997, he got some more publicity when he paid $16.5 million for a 1954 Ferrari automobile, but he's in litigation fighting with the former owner or the auction house that sold it to him, and so forth. Why am I telling you this? Because I want you to understand that the people who are billionaires are only billionaires because the rest of us enable them to be billionaires. The people who go in and spend large amounts of money on the products of Victoria's Secret, when you buy that highly priced piece of clothing, you're feeding the billionaire Mr. Wexner. You're paying for that yacht and that mansion. Every time you shop there, and I don't mean to pick on Victoria's Secret, although I do get a bit of a kick out of it, because I could do the same thing with all the other billionaires, all of whom are in that position because you and I pay the money that flows into their pockets. You might think that if we pay the money, we would have some say about how that money is used. But not in a capitalist system. They can use it, and Mr. Wexner has done it in the way I've just summarized. My next economic update takes me once again to the issue of immigration. I don't mean to harp on it, but it is something that keeps being in the news. Why? Because Mr. Trump and the Republicans think they have a politically viable way to impress people. So now, let's do the numbers to see whether there's any truth in it. The population of the United States is 325 million people, roughly. So if we want to talk about the economic well-being of the American people, we're talking about the economic well-being, the job holders, who are roughly half of that population. How many undocumented immigrants are there? And those are the only ones that are being talked about when there's all this talk about stopping immigration or reversing immigration or expelling undocumented immigrants. Best guess of the United States government, 11.8 million. So let's be clear then, right? We're talking, when we talk about immigration, undocumented immigration, about 11, let's round it off, 12 million people. In a population of 325 million people. Here's a hot flash for all of you. Nothing about that 11.8 million, no matter what happens to them or what is done to them, is going to fundamentally alter the economic situation of the American people. Lots of attention to expelling these 700,000 or closing off the border to these million. You're not talking about things that are going to change the problems of the American people, the economic problems. The whole focus on immigration is fake, is phony. It's a way to distract Americans from the economic problems they do have, serious ones, that affect tens of millions of families in this country, that are not going to be affected one way or the other in any significant degree by anything that is done to the immigrants. So even if you are the kind of American who conveniently forgets that the whole country is a country of immigrants precisely because you wiped out the people who were here when the immigrants first came, and even if you're the kind of American who doesn't care about what it means to expel people at the bottom of the economic ladder who have already suffered from poverty and lack of education and poor housing and all the rest, and you want them to be the butt of your action to fix an economy, fixing it on the backs of those most already impoverished by it? If you don't have any moral problems with that, no ethical problems with that, here's the argument, the reasoning an economist would give you. It's not the issue, friends. Jobs are the issue. Automation is the issue. Unequal distribution of wages and profits is the issue. Our whole capitalist system is the issue. Immigrants aren't the issue. It's as if you told me that the house was on fire, and I told you, take a little nail file and try to work on a corner of the wood at the base of the house. You'd scream at me and say, that's not going to solve the problem of a house on fire. We need a lot of water. We need other things. But filing the corner of a piece of wood, you're crazy. My response as an economist to the discussion of immigration, to seeing Mr. Trump and the Republican leaders and the Democratic leaders arguing and fighting over the, is to see a system whose job it is to distract the mass of people suffering from it from the system itself. Nobody's questioning the system. We're fighting over immigrants. It is a terrible misunderstanding of what's going on that makes all of that possible. Before I go on to other updates, let me remind you, as we always do, to make use of our websites, rdwolf2fs.com and Democracy at Work, that's all one word, democracyatwork.info. Through those websites, you can communicate to us what you like and don't like about the program, what you would like us to cover. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can show us ways we can be more useful to you. For those of you that listen to this program as a radio program or as a podcast, let me remind you that you can also see it as a television program. The easiest way to do that, go to Patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, Patreon.com/economic update, and you can watch this program as a television program. These are all ways of partnering with us. Making us reach more people is something you can help us do, and something we ask you to do as well as invite you to do. The websites are the key way to do that, and they're available to you at no charge ever, 24/7. Continuing on our story. After the tax cut bill was passed in December of last year, a great deal of noise was spent saying how this was, in the words of our president, a middle-class tax cut and so forth. I wanted to do some research to basically answer the question, is the tax cut that was passed by Mr. Trump and the Republicans something that will really transform America's people, fix the middle class, rebuild the middle class, save the middle class, transform its economic situation? So let me tell you the research I did and the results I found. First, I made use of research done by the Tax Policy Center, a nonpartisan, very good, very well qualified research outfit. And they sat down and did a study of how each level of household in America would be affected by the tax cut. Let me give you just a small flavor of what they said. If you earn less than $25,000 a year, so you are among the poorer folks in America, the tax cut will save you, get ready, because it's really going to change your life. If you earn less than $25,000, the tax cut will save you $60. That's right. You heard me. $60. If you earn between $25,000 and $49,000 a year, it will save you $360. If you earn between $49,000 and $86,000 a year, it will save you $930. That's most Americans right there. So most Americans are going to save between $60 and $900. I understand $900 is a significant amount of money for a lot of people. It's not going to transform your life. It's what you save in the entire year, not per week, not per month. That's what you save across 2018 by virtue of that fact. Now, if you are a millionaire, if you earn over, I'll use this number because you might find it interesting. If you earn over $3.4 million a year, here's how much you will save by the tax cut in 2018. Ready? Here we go. $193,380. Let me do that again. If you earn over $3.4 million, you will save nearly $200,000 on your tax. That's a lot of money. In order to save a lot of money, you already have to have a lot of money. That's how this system always works. Nothing new has happened in this tax cut. For the vast majority of Americans, what you save in taxes will not fundamentally change your situation at all. This wasn't a tax cut for you. But it was a tax cut for the really rich. They will now have an extra $200,000. Not you. It was not a tax cut for you. It was a tax cut at your expense, because you have to remember that when they cut all those taxes that don't have to be paid, particularly not by rich people, the next step is to say the government, not getting all that money from people, will not be able to fund a whole lot of programs for school kids, for road maintenance, for college educations. We're going to have a season of cutting because there isn't enough money, because they cut taxes, above all on the rich. So you're going to not get the benefit of the tax cut, but you are likely going to pay the cost of the tax cut, which is in a reduction in the quality and the quantity of public services in the United States, which middle and lower income people rely on more than the folks at the top. You want a tax cut for the middle class? Then give it to the middle class. We don't do that in America. We say we do it, but we don't do it. In case you're wondering, we have actually a case study that proves all this. Back in 2012, a person like Trump, a man named Sam Brownback, became the governor of Kansas. And he did in Kansas what Mr. Trump has now done. He cut taxes on the rich, and he cut taxes on corporations, promising it would really explode the economy of Kansas. It didn't do anything of the sort. Kansas went downward. Its unemployment got worse than the rest of America in a way it hadn't before. There was no explosion of jobs. None of it. So bad is it that in the last session of the Kansas legislature, they put back in the very taxes that they had cut out under Mr. Brownback, and he was dispatched off as an ambassador to someplace abroad. I can't remember the name of the country. He's gone. Gone from Kansas, gone from the United States. A disaster. Because it didn't work in Kansas, it's of course logical that the same kind of politicians will now do it in the country as a whole. Next update. Many of you have no doubt watched with horror the public trial of a doctor who worked on Olympic athletes in the United States, particularly young women, who was also for a long time a professor of medical sciences at Michigan State University. He has been sentenced to spend the rest of his life in jail. He has had to listen to 150 or maybe more young women testify as to what he did to them over 20 or 30 years of being the official doctor for the USA Gymnastics that organizes our Olympic competitors, and likewise his activities at Michigan State. In recent weeks, the president of Michigan State University, other officials there, and likewise the entire board of USA Gymnastics quit. And they quit because of a rising chorus of anger and bitterness, not just from the women who suffered the sexual abuse, the sexual assaults over all those years, not even from the just from their families, their friends, their communities, but from the general public. And I want to say to you a word about that, because there's an economic lesson in all of this. Here's the lesson. If you organize a teaching institution, a university, such as Michigan State, a good, big state university, if you organize it as a school, it behaves in one way. If you organize it as a business, it behaves in a different way. A business depends on customers. It is afraid to reveal any of its shortcomings to its customers, lest they go someplace else. It's afraid to admit to its shareholders or those who control it that it did bad things for fear they will invest somewhere else. Businesses tend to hide the illegal, the immoral that they do, because it's in their interest to do that. The behavior of the people who run Michigan State University is the behavior of people in a business. It turns out that the police department of Michigan State University received something on the order of 100 complaints from young athletes at the university about this same Dr. Nasser. Some of them were pursued, some of them weren't. Nothing ever happened. The administration failed to take the most minimal protections. How in the world did you not have a major investigation after 100 complaints? What is the possibility that you didn't know? That's not serious. That you didn't care? I'm not willing to assume that about these people. I don't think they're monsters. But they are caught up in a system that rewards them for keeping it quiet, for hushing it up, for not letting anyone know. And when you do that, you don't expose the problem and you don't solve the problem. You subordinate the solving of the problem to the keeping up of your income, your money, your profits. Long ago, we made major universities into businesses that sell sports, that sell events, that sell all kinds of things. They even sell positions in their schools. That's not healthy. And one of the prices you pay when you mix business with education is you get business-type results, hiding, dissimulating, making money, even at the expense of the most basic kinds of human care for one another. Michigan State stands exposed, but these problems are not unique to Michigan State. They affect the entire universe of higher education and other institutions. Being businesslike has always been a very mixed bag. We've come to the end of Economic Update's first half hour. Please stay with us. I think you'll find the second half hour today as interesting, if not more. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of today's Economic Update. Well, we're going to do something a little bit different from what we usually do, because I want to dedicate today's program to a bicentennial, to something that happened 200 years ago this year, particularly, to be precise, 1818, 200 years ago, something which for many years was taboo to talk about in the United States, but I'm happy to tell you, as you probably know, that that taboo was lifting. So what is it that happened in 1818? Karl Marx was born, an important figure in the history of the world, whose 200th anniversary of his birth is worth thinking about. What did Mr. Marx do? What impact has it had on the world? Is it still relevant? And if so, how? Before I jump in, though, let me talk a little bit about that taboo I just mentioned. Earlier in American history, before the Second World War, there were pretty often discussions about Marx, Marxism, and the influence of Marx's work and what exactly he said and didn't say. Scholars debated it. Political activists debated it. But after World War II, politics in America changed. Particularly, we went from being the ally of the Soviet Union in World War II, fighting against the Germans and the Japanese, the Nazis and the Japanese. We went from there to declaring the Soviet Union our number one enemy. The Soviet Union was a country that celebrated Karl Marx, that said it derived its strategies and legitimacy from Karl Marx's writings. And so, with the Soviet Union as the great enemy, Marxism became the great enemy, and Karl Marx became the evil inspirer of the great enemy. And this led Americans, particularly, to turn away from the works of Karl Marx and many of the Marxists that followed him and were inspired by him, both Americans and non-Americans, turn away from them and turn away from even reading the material, declaring it so terrible, so evil, so noxious that the best thing was not to crack open the book, not to engage the ideas, to dismiss it. And so it was, starting in the late 1940s, and basically up to the present. It's beginning to break up in the last 10 years, but just beginning. But for most of the last half century, reading, studying, thinking about the works of Karl Marx was a taboo in the United States, and the vast majority of people did not do it. Moreover, they were helped because the journalists in America, the politicians in the American system, and the academicians, the teachers and the professors, paid no attention to it, didn't teach it in the class. If it even came up in the class, it was dismissed in a cursory way with no engagement, often by a teacher who had no familiarity himself or herself with it and couldn't have engaged it in a serious way because they had never done so as students themselves. As I say, it's beginning to break up now. But I want to assert that it was always a mistake to behave this way. Even if you think the Soviet Union is your great enemy, that's not a reason not to study what inspires its behavior. It's a reason to study it all the more. You want to understand what they're doing and why they're doing it, even if you hate what they stand for. And then there's always the possibility that if a major part of the world, let's say Russia and China, are inspired by Karl Marx, as they are, and if it turns out that Russia is the largest country by geography in the world, and the People's Republic of China is the largest country by population, so you have the largest geographic entity and the largest population, that's enough of a reason to study what inspires them. To do otherwise isn't a sign of political sophistication. It's a sign of abject fear mingled with ignorance. And that's not a good idea anywhere, ever. So I'm not going to participate. I haven't for most of my life, so to be honest with you, it's old hat for me by now. I want to talk to you about Mr. Marx. And yes, it's because I think we can learn from what the fella had to say. And there in no way am I unique. Because Mr. Marx's ideas and writings have been translated into every language on the face of this planet. There is no country in the world that doesn't have its Marxist professors, its Marxist newspapers, its Marxist trade unions, its Marxist political parties, and a whole lot of other Marxist things. And that's because an awful lot of people in the most diverse circumstances have found these writings of enormous interest. In fact, you'd have a hard time finding more than a handful of other examples of such a dispersion of interest, so many people in so many situations finding valuable lessons in what has been written under the influence of Karl Marx. So I don't shrink away from saying I've got something to learn, too. I don't even shrink away, as I'm not doing today, from suggesting you too could have something to learn, and I want to help make that possible. So let's talk about Karl Marx. Born, as I said, in 1818, died in 1883. So basically, this is a man who lives across the 19th century. Born near the beginning, dies near the end. He was born in what we would nowadays call a middle-class family, an educated father and mother, which in those days a very small number of people had education. He went to the university. I would guess 3-4% of the population of young people in Germany, where he was born, went to the university. So already you're talking about a very particular part of the population. Not only did he go to the university, but he went all the way through to a doctoral dissertation, a PhD, which was in the field of Greek philosophy. That's what he wrote his dissertation on. He studied all kinds of philosophy. That's what he loved. But as he was going through the university, he began to be touched, as many students were, although there were always many who weren't, by the social struggles around him. He wasn't shut off from what was happening in the towns and cities where the universities were located. He began to notice that there were people in the streets fighting for things. There were struggles at the workplace, struggles in the countryside, political... He became interested, as students often do. And then two things happened more or less at the same time in his life. He got caught up in one of the great revolutionary periods of European history. These were called the revolutions of 1848. If you study European history, you will learn that there were revolutions in England, in Scandinavia, in Italy, in France, in Germany, everywhere. It was a revolutionary upheaval. He got caught up in that because he was a young person at the time. He was in his 20s, late 20s, early 30s. And he began to be critical about the philosophy he had been taught and the philosophy he loved to do and his job as a young philosophy instructor in a university. First real job he got. And he began to study things that were closer to the political upheavals that captured his attention. He studied political science. He studied economics. He studied history. He wanted to understand not just how people thought about the world, but what they did and why they did it. And then he even asked himself the question, why did they think those thoughts rather than other thought? What's going on to shape the philosophy he studies? This got him in trouble because as a young student, he sided with the rebels. He sided with the critics. He sided with the people who wanted a better life. He was a radical, or he was becoming one. And what happened to him as a young radical, late 20s, early 30s, was what was done by governments who didn't like to see students getting active in those years, particularly not with workers who wanted a better life. They didn't kill them, and they didn't imprison them. It's not what they did. They exiled them. They threw them out of the country. So what the German police did to this young radical Karl Marx, coming from a very good family with a very big pedigree as a philosopher, they threw him out of Germany. They put him on a train to France. But the German police informed the French police that he was coming. So the French police met him in Paris at the train station and said, you can't stay here either. And they put him on another train that went to Brussels in Belgium. It's only about an hour and a half train ride. And he arrived in Brussels, same thing happened, and they put him on a train, then a boat, to London, England, which is where Karl Marx spent the rest of his life, as an immigrant in London. He had to learn the English language, he had to learn to write and speak in it, and he had to survive as a refugee, a political refugee, in that part of Europe, England, which was open to refugees more than any other part at that time. I mention it because I want everyone to know that Marx spent most of his adult life and wrote all of his mature works as a resident of an English-speaking country. English-speaking was not alien to him. It became his daily language. Well, what did he do? What did he write? What was the thing that made his work so interesting and so powerful in the world since? So that the very word Marx or Marxist to this day in many parts of the United States and elsewhere frightens people, worries people, makes them anxious as if something scary or dangerous were in the air. What's this all about? Well, Marx was always a philosopher, always a thinker, and that's really what he did in his life. He didn't participate that much in political activity, a little, but mostly giving speeches or writing pamphlets, things like that. And mostly he spent time reading and thinking and writing to understand what was going on, and hopefully to share his understanding with others. That's Marx's politics. He was not the leader of any government. He was not the leader of any political party. He didn't stand for election in any country ever at any time. He was a thinker, a theorist, a writer. He influenced people. But that was the limit of what he did. So what were the big questions that moved him? What did he try to learn? What did he try to understand? It begins in a very personal way with Karl Marx. The great thing that excited him as a young man was the French Revolution, the Revolution of 1789. That revolution overthrew feudalism in Europe, particularly in France, where it took place. And the slogans of that revolution were absolutely ecstatic for a whole generation of young Europeans. The slogans of that revolution, in case you don't remember, were three words: equality, fraternity, and liberty. Liberty of the individual, equality among individuals, and solidarity, brotherhood, fraternity among individuals. The French Revolution committed itself to realizing liberty, equality, and fraternity in 1789. Remember, Marx is born 30 years after that revolution, reaches his maturity half a century after that revolution. And so here's the big question he asks himself. Do I live here in Western Germany, or later in Paris, or later in London? Do I live in a society that is the realized promise of liberty, equality, and fraternity? Did the French Revolution, whose slogans I love and whose slogans my generation embraces, did it achieve what it set out to achieve? Do we have liberty, equality, and fraternity? And Marx's unequivocal answer, as he looked around the Europe of his time, the Europe of 1848, 1850, 1860, was a resounding no way. For those of you who have ever read the novels of Charles Dickens, remember the descriptions of England that made Dickens famous? Those were descriptions of a society of grotesque inequality. There was no equality. The gap between rich and poor was every day visible in every city and town of Europe. Liberty? How can you be free if your next meal is uncertain for you? Fraternity? People didn't treat each other as brothers. They treated each other as means to an end. Means that you could dispose of whenever you needed to. So then Marx's question became, why? Why did the revolutions of 1789 in France, and he might have mentioned the American Revolution around that time too, why did they not realize a society of liberty, equality, and fraternity? We could modernize his question by saying, why didn't they achieve the liberty, equality, fraternity, and democracy in whose name those revolutions had been made? Might there be, Marx asked himself, something these revolutionaries didn't get, didn't see, didn't understand, that made them fail? He took them at their word. They wanted liberty, equality, fraternity, and democracy. They made revolutions for that purpose. The Americans overthrew King George III and all that that represented. The French overthrew Louis XIV and all the Marie Antoinette and all of that. They wanted, like Jefferson or any of the others, they wanted a new society of liberty, equality, but they didn't get it. It wasn't there in Europe as Marx reached his maturity. So he asked himself, here's something I can do. Can I figure out, I'm Marx, what it was that prevented the good society that they all wanted to achieve from being realized? What might it be? And his answer was his life. He devoted himself to answering that question. What was it? What did they miss? What has to happen to realize liberty, equality, fraternity, and democracy in the world the way we actually live it? And here's what he came up with. They missed something. They all missed something. And thanks to all the things they figured out, I can figure out what they missed. So I'm not a Monday morning quarterback saying, oh, you didn't do it right. Without the things they achieved, I wouldn't be able to figure out where they went wrong. So I'm just part of them figuring out what we have to do that we didn't do first time around. So what was it? And here comes what I think is Marx's number one achievement. And by the way, I should explain. Here it is, early in 2018. We're talking about Marx because it's his 200th birthday and it's an important topic. Later this year, we will have a more developed, a more detailed analysis because it's so important. Here, in a way, I want to tell you it's coming and to maybe tease you just a little by showing you why it's important to do this. So let's get back. What did Marx achieve? His answer was to say, we haven't paid enough attention to production. We look at society, we ask, who's the government and what do they do? We, if we're philosophers, we ask, what are the big ideas and how do they shape up in people's minds? And that's all interesting and important to understand society. But we have neglected something we are now paying dearly for. We've neglected the importance of how each society organizes the production of the goods and services without which it cannot live. The food, the clothing, the shelter, the housing, that you name it. And I think therein what we've missed is the crucial thing that explains why we haven't been more successful building a society based on liberty, equality, fraternity, and democracy. Well, what is it about production we missed? It's the organization. It's how we as people get together to produce the goods and services without which we can't live. And then he does it. He says, let me show you what I mean. For much of human history, it's been organized in three ways. The first one we call slavery. In that arrangement, one person owns another person. The owned person, the slave, does all the work, and whatever the slave produces flows into the hands of the master, the other one. And the master gives some of it back to the slave because he wants to keep this system going, but the rest of it, the surplus, what the slave produces over and above what he gets back, that surplus goes to the master, and he uses it any way he sees fit. And at a certain point, the slaves revolt, and that system explodes. And then we have another one, and we call that feudalism, Marx teaches. And there we have, again, a dualistic system, two players, the serf and the lord. The serf is sort of like a slave, and the lord is sort of like a master. But they don't own each other, because it's not slavery. The serf works on the land that the lord kind of presides over, and the serf produces more than the serf keeps, and that more, that surplus, goes to the lord, who makes beautiful castles and lovely societies for himself. Much of Europe had been slave or serfdom before the capitalist period. And the capitalists develop, and that's a new system, Marx says. It's new in the sense it's not slavery, nobody owns anybody, and it's not lord and serf. That's all overthrown. But what's put in its place, the hope is, by the people who make the capitalist revolutions, the French revolutionaries of 1789, the American revolutionaries of 1776, they hoped for liberty, equality, fraternity, and democracy. What they got, though, was a new capitalist system. In their minds, the capitalist system would deliver liberty, equality, fraternity, and democracy. So they instituted capitalism. And here comes Marx's insight. In doing that, they misunderstood that what capitalism isn't the end of the old dualities, slave, master, serf, lord. It's just a new form of the same thing. The new form is employee and employer. Once again, the employees do all the work. Produce all the output. They deliver it to the boss, the employer. He takes a portion of it, gives it back to them. We call that the wage and the salary. The remaining part, the surplus, produced by the employee, belongs to the employer, who uses it to organize a society that serves him first and foremost. So Marx's explanation, his breakthrough was, we didn't understand that if you want liberty, equality, fraternity, and democracy in the society, you've got to put it in the workplace. You've got to include the production system, because if you don't, if you leave the production system with a dominant employer and a subordinate employee, it'll be as unequal, unliberty, undemocratic as were the slaveries and the feudalisms before. To have a society of equality, liberty, fraternity, and democracy, you have to build those in to the production process, to the factory, the office, the store, the workshop. Only then, if we all together decide what gets produced and how it gets produced and where it gets produced, and we get this together, excuse me, decide what to do with this surplus, this extra we produce over and above what we need as workers ourselves. Only then will we have created the conditions in the workplace that will allow in the larger society the liberty, equality, fraternity, and democracy that we want to be achieved. In other words, Marx's great discovery was the revolution isn't over yet. We haven't done it yet. Is the end of slavery a good thing? For sure. Marx was always clear about that. Is the overthrow of feudalism a good thing? Yes. But we're not done. We might wish we had been done. We might wish that capitalism had ushered in liberty, equality, fraternity. It hoped it could. The people who made those revolutions hoped it could. But it didn't happen. And we have to ask the question, Marx, why it didn't. And I think I've figured it out. Because we didn't change the organization of production. And what would that mean? It's not that complicated. It means the workplace has to change. No longer do a tiny group of people at the top decide what gets produced, how it gets produced, where it gets produced, and what is done with the profits. No more board of directors of a corporation making all those decisions while the tens of thousands of employees come to work, do their work, go home, watch television, drink beer, and repeat the whole game tomorrow. Uh-uh. If you want liberty, equality, fraternity, and democracy, it begins, it has to begin at the workplace. If you don't do it in the workplace and you try to do it elsewhere in society, you will fail. That's what the history of capitalism shows us. It won't work. You won't get it. And you will have to then convince yourself that you can't do better in the human experience beyond capitalism, which is what all capitalist systems try to convince their people. We are the best. We are as far as it goes. We are the best you can do. Look, feudalism, Marx tells us, tried to convince people that the lord and the serf was the best you could do. And before that, the masters tried to convince the slaves it was the best you could do. In the end, history undid them. And Marx is very confident that in the end, as people live under capitalism and watch how it works, its operations, the inequalities it produces, the instability of these endless business cycles, the whole unjust system that it spawns, isn't the best human beings can do. And then he thinks the same revolutionary spirit that got rid of slavery and got rid of feudalism will turn its criticism upon capitalism and ask, how can we do better than capitalism? And for that, Marx says, he thinks he's found the answer. Transform the workplace from a capitalist hierarchical to an egalitarian worker cooperative. It's an extraordinary piece of work. It has had staggering social implications for 150 years. Makes no sense to ignore it. It makes no sense to do anything other than interrogate it for whatever lessons for today it might be able to give us. And that's what we're going to be doing later this year, the 200th bicentennial of Karl Marx's birth. Thank you very much for being with us this week. I hope you found this interesting. I want to thank our partner, truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis. And I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
This is Mitch Jeserich, and I'm very happy to tell you that our winter fund drive is over. Now, on behalf of everyone at KPFA, I want to thank you dearly for your generous support. Now, we did fall short of our overall goal, but we did keep our part of the bargain by ending on time. Now, if you're a listener that intended to pledge, well, you can still do so by going online at kpfa.org. Our thank you gifts are all still available. Remember, you are essential in keeping KPFA on the air, and so we encourage you to donate today. kpfa.org. Thank you.
Welcome to another episode of the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we spend the hour discussing proud contested media, critical media literacy, and fighting fake news. Chase Palmieri from Tribeworthy comes back to the program to talk about Tribeworthy.com and how crowd contested media can help build trust among news users in a increasingly confusing landscape of fake news. In the second part of the program, we're joined by veteran investigative reporter Dave Lindorf of ThisCan'tBeHappening.net, and we'll be discussing his latest article about how Washington has long engaged in information warfare, including fake news and trolling. Stay with us.
Perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. For the first segment of today's program, we are joined once again by Chase Palmieri of Tribeworthy.com. Chase is a self-described news junkie who serves as CEO and co-founder of Tribeworthy.com, the home of Proud Contested Media. Chase and his team are building trust among online news consumers by holding authors and news outlets accountable with a review system similar to Yelp and Rotten Tomatoes. Project Censored has had Chase Palmieri and the members of Tribeworthy on the program before. And we've also done several public events with Tribeworthy as they do a form of critical media literacy education online. And it's a great interface and user-friendly platform to help build trust among news sources. And in the last year, Tribeworthy has been upping their game. They've been monitoring and updating their sites, and they also have some new offerings. And we are pleased to be rejoined for the first segment by Chase Palmieri. Chase, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks, Mickey.
So remind our listeners, in case they don't know, what exactly is Tribeworthy.com? Where did this idea come from?
It's funny you say that because the history originated about three blocks away. We're here speaking in Petaluma, and my father and I started a restaurant, Reezy Beezy, down the street here. And I was managing the Yelp campaign for our restaurant when I got out of business college. And I came home and was running that campaign for my dad. And I was seeing all these reviews coming in, and I was seeing customers, mostly happy reviews, but then you'd see somebody that would leave a review because the calamari came out cold. And during all of this, I was living deep in the online news world, and this was pre-term of fake news, pre-fake news hysteria, but the trends and the direction of which, where it was going was still pretty obvious at the time. And so I started to ask myself, how is it that customers can review a restaurant for calamari coming out cold, but news consumers have no way of holding news producers accountable? We can see blatant logical fallacies or biases in these publications, but we have no way of attaching a rating or holding these outlets or authors accountable. And so that was kind of the aha moment and initial sense of injustice that started Tribeworthy.
So you saw a need, and it's interesting, too, that you have a business background. But given that you have that background, you believe quite strongly that there should be accountability, there should be a place for feedback, there should be a way for many people in the community to give feedback to create an optimum experience, right? And taking that from the restaurant world to the news world means that people should be able to collectively work together to give feedback to news agencies about when they're inaccurate or about when they're covering titillating sensational information or junk food news, as we call it at Project Censored, or when information is overly biased or it's propaganda, right? You're saying that maybe the best defense against this kind of assault, or now that the term fake news is a thing, one of the best ways to address that is through what you call crowd contested media. So can you talk a little bit about that term?
Yeah, crowd-contested media is a term that we ourselves made up. We invented the term because we felt that it best described what we're doing. And what we are doing is we're essentially connecting news consumers and allowing them to share a collective voice and to use that voice to try to raise the standards of online journalism. When you think about the landscape before Tribeworthy, and which is still what most people would call just the landscape because we're still a very young site, you would pretty much go about gathering news alone. And even when you're gathering news on Facebook, on these social platforms like Twitter and Facebook and Reddit, when you click through to a news article, you're ultimately left on your own. There was nobody there to warn you of what the quality of the content is that you just landed on. There's no way of knowing what the history of this source is or the history of this author's leanings are. Essentially, every time you land on a piece of information, you're left to your own devices. And we started to think, well, what would it look like if we tried to allow news consumers to really collaborate properly and in real time as they go about their natural news gathering? And what would that really look like? And that's a big part of what we launched today, actually, which is, and it's going to sound complicated to people, but it's really not, a Chrome browser extension. But really all that means is it's this one little widget that you download onto your Chrome browser, which is what most people use to surf the internet today. And using this little extension that you download, you can now be gathering news in real time with all of your fellow news consumers that are also on the extension. So you would land on an article before Tribeworthy, and if you had an issue with the article, if there was an outright bias, you might just exit out of the article, and you would have done nothing to warn the next reader. But now you would simply review that article right then and there using our review process, and it would tag that flaw, maybe a particular logical fallacy or a gender bias, a certain mistake, and you would tag that flaw to the lifetime URL of that article. And then any other news consumers that came and landed on that article after you would have the benefit of your review.
So, Chase Palmieri, it's also important to point out, as you do, and just wanted to also remind listeners that Chase has an article in the latest Project Censored book. We were quite impressed with the work that Tribeworthy was doing, and Andy Lee Roth and I invited Chase and the Tribeworthy crew to submit a piece for the Censored 2018 book, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World, in Chapter 3, Media Democracy in Action. Well, this is a perfect opportunity to showcase an organization like Tribeworthy, because you're literally talking about media democracy. You're talking about giving people the opportunity to weigh in and give feedback that follows the article around online. You mentioned your Chrome extension browser. Is that it? Your browser extension?
Right.
And the website, by the way, again, is tribeworthy.com, so you can go there. But I also wanted to point out that you write that Tribeworthy is not a fact-checking organization. So you're not PolitiFact, you're not Snopes.
Correct.
So let's talk about, I mean, again, those are fine organizations in terms of their general intent. Their general intent is to fact check. Their general intent is to call out falsehoods. We won't spend too much time talking about some of the other internal problems, either at Snopes or at PolitiFact or some of these other sites or some of their own biases, right? One of the real challenges of those sites is it's basically akin to outsourcing the critical thinking process. So tell us, why is Tribeworthy not a fact checking organization?
First off, we're not a fact checking organization simply because we never make claims as to the validity of information ourselves. Just like Yelp would never come into your town and say, hey, this Denny's restaurant is the best restaurant in town. There's simply a medium for users, the customer, the end user, to leave a critique of their experience with that particular product or service. And so that's what we do with Tribeworthy, is we're simply the middleman capturing these critiques on these articles and then redisplaying them in a way that it's very practical and useful.
And you wrote about this, of course, in the piece Tribeworthy, Crowd Contested Media and Censor 2018. You also make another couple of observations about the challenges, the realistic challenges that fact-checking sites face.
Essentially, fact-checking organizations were more useful when there were gatekeepers to who could actually publish content. With the internet, those walls came down, and now the three of us sitting in this room could easily produce content ourselves today. And the gatekeepers are gone, which means that there is now a flood of new information that has entered the news and information ecosystem. And fact checkers simply cannot scale to cover and validate all of these articles because of at the rate they're being produced, it's just simply unfeasible. And a lot of these fact-checking organizations are simply non-profitable organizations that can't even scale the business side of their operations to try to bring in the manpower to do so. So the only way that we see the future of testing and checking the validity of online information is to give this power into the hands of the news consumers themselves. Because if not, you either are relying on fact-checking organizations, which can only fact-check maybe 5 articles a day, which isn't very useful to anyone, or you're relying on algorithms that are simply designed to display information or try to weed out certain information. That's not really the safest thing for a democracy, especially when the power is being controlled by some of these giant media conglomerates that tend to stick to the mainstream narrative.
We're talking with Chase Palmieri, co-founder of Tribeworthy.com, Tribeworthy Crowd Contested Media. You can learn more at Tribeworthy.com, and you can read an essay that Chase wrote in the new Censored 2018 book. So, Chase Palmieri, what do you see as a potential threshold before you can really make claims that people are getting something out of this?
That's a fantastic question, and that's one of the most asked questions, is how many reviews do you need on an article before it actually becomes useful? The short answer is, right now when you land on an article, you have zero reviews and ratings, so even one well-written, thoughtful critique of a news article that you now have access to that you didn't have before is helpful. And again, you don't have to take it for its word, just like with Rotten Tomatoes. If a movie was rated at 85%, it's your own prerogative whether you want to go see an action film with an 85% rating or not. You have more data points to kind of make that decision based on. And you have to look at the explanation from your other fellow news consumers as to why they selected the specific flaw in the article or why they say they trust an article. As for how many users we would need on the platform to really make the impact that we need about just enough to scare journalists and news outlets into caring about their public ratings. So what we are hoping is that the wise journalists and the wise news outlets will try to adopt this new metric that we are measuring, which is essentially the public's trust in a particular article. And what's interesting is by reviewing an online article, you're actually reviewing upstream. So when you review an article, you're also creating a review for the journalist or the author of that article, because they're essentially just the average of all of their content that's out there. And you're also reviewing the publication that signed off on it. So author A created article B, and you reviewing article B also reviewed author A, and you therefore also reviewed the publication C that signed off on that author's publication.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we're speaking with Chase Palmieri. He is co-founder of Tribeworthy, crowd-contested media. You can learn more at tribeworthy.com. We'll be back to continue our conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. On this segment of the program today, we're joined once again by Chase Palmieri. Chase is the CEO and co-founder of Tribeworthy.com, the home of crowd-contested media. Chase and his team are building trust among online news consumers by holding authors and news outlets accountable with a review system similar to Yelp and or Rotten Tomatoes. And full disclosure, want to make sure listeners remember that Chase Palmieri and Tribeworthy are featured in the newest Project Censored book, Censored 2018. And I also have consulted with Tribeworthy in the past, particularly on critical media literacy education issues. That's one of the things that really stood out about the idea behind Tribeworthy was it wasn't just a thumbs up or a thumbs down, but it was actually going in and saying, well, why do you trust an article or why do you not trust an article? And then there's a series of templates you can go through and you can pick out various logical fallacies and these types of things. So, Chase Palmieri, what if somebody goes to Tribeworthy.com? What are they going to run into? And what are those clicks and those steps? And again, the reason I want you to walk through this is because it's really a fairly easy process.
Right. It's very easy. Just to take a quick step back, Tribeworthy is just simply a play on the word trustworthy, but as decided by our tribe of users. So again, it's Tribeworthy, all one word, .com. And when you get to the website, you'll see a feed of articles that you can filter by topic or by rating, which is something that is unique only to us because we are essentially the only website online for news today that is capturing ratings associated with these articles. And so as you're browsing articles on our website, you can browse by headline and by rating. And what you'll see that's different on our site is the initial article that you're seeing in the feed it doesn't list the author and news outlet, because our goal is to actually open people up to content that they're not necessarily used to reading, but that is still accurate and credible and worth their time. And so you're always one click away from being able to see the source information, but the idea is that we are trying to open people up to a larger audience, these smaller independent outlets that are doing great work and deserve to be rewarded with more traffic. Because that's really what's killing a lot of these outlets today, is they make their money, for better or worse, by monetizing users' eyeballs. And when users don't spend time to learn and trust these independent outlets, they end up just going to the mainstream outlets that they have known and don't necessarily trust, but they kind of already think that they understand the political leanings. It's harder to try to go read on a new outlet and try to uncover their political leanings on the spot. But that's all things that you can do with Tribeworthy. So if you're on the website, you would browse for articles. You might find a headline you're interested in, but it might have a poor rating. And then you could find an article on the same topic with a higher rating and spend your time reading that one. Again, we're not censoring articles because every article is there for you to see and read, but we are associating their ratings with them, holding them accountable and hopefully trying to redirect traffic to the best of the best. And once you read that article, you're sent away from our site. You're sent to the actual site because we want to reward the good journalism that these people are doing. So we have to send them the users so that they can monetize you as the way that they see fit. But when you're done reading that article, unlike anywhere else, and especially now with comment sections shutting down on most news outlet websites just because of bad behavior and the fact that they don't have the time or want to take the time to read your comments anyway, we're pretty much the only place where you can come leave a thoughtful, critical review. And like you were saying about how you were consulting us back in the day, you're very instrumental in helping us put together a review process that had previously never existed. We essentially had to design a review process for critical media literacy, and we had to do it in as few steps as possible. We've managed to do it in 2 steps, which is really impressive, because this is not supposed to feel like homework. This is supposed to feel just like a natural extension of your thought process as you're reading the article and as you complete an article. Because you already are leaving a review, in a sense, in your own head as to whether or not you trust an article or why not. But we're simply capturing it. Just like Yelp, before it existed, people were going to restaurants and leaving and telling each other through word of mouth or having either a good experience or a bad experience. Yelp began to capture that information and start to display it in a way that was more helpful. We're simply doing the same thing, but with readers' trust.
I'm noticing, too, by looking at the site, that your site is not cluttered by advertisements.
No, it's not. That is not the direction that we aim to monetize, but we will monetize in the future, but it's still a very long way away because we're early and a platform doesn't really monetize until you have a large enough user base. But I think everybody listening has a right to know how we monetize, or how we plan to monetize at least. And again, turning over to Yelp, because they've paved this pathway for us. Many people nowadays, when they search for a local business, they no longer search on Google. They actually go into Yelp and search for a local business through Yelp. And the reason being that you have all of this added value that you can see people's ratings and reviews inside of the search results. And so what has Yelp been able to do because of that? Well, now they have more search traffic, and they've been able to promote certain restaurants in those top 2 positions. And they do it in a very transparent way by placing ad next to it. And obviously an Italian restaurant shows up when you're searching for Italian restaurants. So it's all still very relevant to the user, still very transparent. And we're essentially planning to do the same thing. There'll come a time where hopefully most of the news-related search traffic will be coming through Tribeworthy, because right now when you go to Google and you search for a headline or an article, every single search result for 3,000 pages looks the exact same. There's no 5-star ratings. There's nothing giving you a sense of whether you should click on one headline versus another. And so that's the added value that we're going to be able to offer, and we hope to steal away a significant portion of the news-related search from Google and to monetize that.
So how do you see Tribeworthy then working in concert with journalists or with journalistic institutions or publications?
Again, like Yelp, there will be claimable business profile pages. So a journalist will be able to come in here, claim their author rating page. They'll be able to fill out their profile, fill out additional information that will be helpful for the news consumers, but also for the news producer to kind of defend the rigor of their journalistic standards. And the same thing for news outlets. They'll come in and claim their pages. And the ones that pay attention to their ratings earliest will have the fewest blemishes on their ratings. And when the tip comes and people start to decide to read articles based on these ratings, which is, you know, a dream far out, but it is something that we think is the future of news, whether it's us or another organization, they're going to have to care about their trust rating in the public eye. They'll be rewarded with greater traffic and therefore greater revenue. And now it will no longer be based on who can write the most clickbaity headline and trick you into coming in. It'll be based on who is performing at the highest level of journalistic integrity and rigor, and traffic is coming in that way.
So, Chase Palmieri, it's not about clicks, likes, and shares.
No, it's about user trust, ultimately. These have all just been little shortcuts, temporary, short-term fixes that in turn broke other things. But ultimately, it's going to come down to where do readers want to spend their time, because where do they trust?
Again, Triberthy has been on the critical media literacy education circuit. They've done a number of public addresses. They've participated in conferences. They've been networking through a lot of educators through the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, Project Censored, many other groups. Our good friend Abby Martin just gave you all a really nice endorsement. So you're actually attracting more and more attention from a lot of serious journalists, from people that are doing good work, that think that this will be, as you said, maybe not tomorrow, but in the future, this could be the gold standard of building trust among community for journalists.
Yeah, we think it is. And there's another reason for that. And it's that most of the solutions being proposed around online news today don't account for how trust is actually built in the digital world. They're trying to take something that is out here in the public space and bring it online, but they're not actually designing platforms for how trust is built online. And so when you look at platforms where trust is built, where somebody goes, looks at information and then makes a decision with confidence based on it, you can look at platforms like Yelp. You can look at Goodreads, Rotten Tomatoes, any of these platforms, TripAdvisor, where you can clearly at a glance see the collective sentiment of consumers around a particular product or service. And that's never existed for news consumers. It's refreshing to see news consumers actually being given a voice.
Indeed it is, and that's naturally what attracted Andy Roth and I and Project Censored to what you were doing, and to try to support you not just getting off the ground, but just letting people know that care about this stuff that you're here. You're rising to that occasion, right, to help build trust in this so-called era of fake news, right? You're really trying to address this. And again, fact checkers can't scale. Blacklists are obviously a violation of freedom of expression and free press rights. Legislation is incredibly problematic. There's no way you can ban poor reporting or false reporting technically.
And we wouldn't want to.
No, but we could apply critical media literacy education skills, critical thinking, and you're providing a platform online for people to do that. You have an app. You now have a browser extension with Chrome.
We have an iPhone app and a Chrome extension, yeah.
Yeah, so you're making this even easier for people to get a hold of this. I also want to point out to listeners that you're all millennials. You're a millennial generation. You're young people that are doing this. I have to point that out because we often hear so much how the youth are not doing anything and they're apathetic and they're not voting or what have you. And what I've seen certainly in our work with social justice particularly is that young people are spearheading all of these movements of change, social change. And this is yet another one, right? Triberthy is another, I think, a very significant one because as Nicholas Johnson, the former FCC chairman, once said, whatever your first priority, if your second priority isn't reforming the media or building trust in the media, you're likely to get not very far in your first area of interest. And Triberthy to me seems like another way of helping build trust and really encouraging people to think independently on their own. So Chase Palmieri, some of our listeners may know that Facebook has recently created a system allegedly for rating news, and there's a couple of other organizations out there that are trying to address this issue after they got hit hard by the fake news claims after the last election. What's different about that versus Triberthy?
Facebook is actually downgrading the amount of news content in their newsfeed, down all the way to 4%. So that tells you the direction they're headed. And They say it's because they want to get back to being about the connection between friends and family. But the truth of it is they came dangerously close to becoming regulated. That's the thing that terrifies Facebook. That's what terrifies them more than anything. And so they're happy to remove themselves from the news space where all of the heat is and just play in all of the other social space and remain an unregulated entity. And that creates an opportunity for us, obviously. The thing about Facebook that's interesting is when you look at Facebook, a lot of people gather their news there. And you have to ask yourself why. And the reason is because people naturally want to gather news in a collaborative way. But Facebook is not designed for it. It became that because it was the most collaborative space. And so news entered the space. And then it thrived in that space. What we've done is we've designed a platform that is social at its core, but it's designed with a focus on news. It's not designed for anything low quality. It is purely based on news.
So this leads me to one more question, and I know that you hear this. You've certainly heard this before. How is Triberthy up to the challenge of bots and algorithms and trolls?
The truth is that we're not quite there yet, but luckily we have more pressing problems in front of us. We are not enough of a threat where people feel the need to come and mess with us, but we are preparing for that threat. One of the ways we're doing so is actually not only are our articles held accountable with a rating and authors and news outlets, but reviewers themselves on the platform actually have a user rating, a score as well. And that's based on how helpful the reviews are that they're leaving for other news consumers. So if a troll comes in and they leave a very hateful comment that is unhelpful, it's just unobjective, and it's not doing anything to protect the next news consumer, and it's mostly just trying to talk about the content and less about the actual quality of the reporting, well, those reviews are downvoted, and therefore that user's score is downvoted, and that is all laid out very transparently so that you can see at a glance, again, designing for at-a-glance behavior, you can see at a glance whether or not you should even trust that reviewer's review.
We're speaking with Chase Palmieri, co-founder of Tribeworthy.com, crowd-contested media. If you go to their webpage and click on About, you can see online news is no longer a spectator sport. Tribeworthy is a fun community-based news gathering and review platform. Join forces with other news consumers to find trustworthy online articles. Stay informed with minimal time and effort and improve everyone's daily news gathering. Well, that certainly sounds like a great idea, and you've put it together here, Chase Palmieri. Anything you'd like to add here?
Like I said at the very beginning, we just launched our Chrome browser extension. The reason we did so is that people liked the Tribeworthy website. I found it useful, but it was not matching their natural news gathering. We weren't actually solving the problem for them out in the real world where they're coming face to face with these articles, clicking through Facebook and landing on an article. People didn't want to have to grab the URL of an article, come over to Tribeworthy, post it on the Tribeworthy, review it there, and go through this whole process. They wanted to, when they land on an online article, they wanted to know what the rating is, what other news consumers were saying about that article right then and there. And when they're done reading the article, they wanted to review it right then and there. And that's what the Chrome browser extension does.
We've been speaking with Chase Palmieri from Tribeworthy.com. And if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, I know the show airs all around the country, but March 5th to 9th will be at Sonoma State University Social Justice Week. Project Censored's one of the co-sponsors of that event. Ralph Nader speaking. I'll be speaking on fake news. Glenn Ford will be there. So many other people will be there. And also Tribeworthy will be there. Chase and Jared and some of the Tribeworthy team will be there throughout the week. So if you're around and you can get out to Sonoma State University, come check it out. And please check out the website at Tribeworthy.com. If you are an educator, there is an educator page, and it links to the Global Critical Media Literacy Project Educators Resource Guide, which we put together a couple of years ago. But it also has the contacts for Chase and for Jared and a few of the other folks you work with. So you can, educators can email you directly about how they can get involved, how they can get students signed up to participate. I know I do this in class. Nolan Higdon, a lot of the faculty we work with, they actually have students go and use the Tribeworthy site as part of assignments, extra credit, other things.
Right.
And it also helps you build the platform.
Not only that, but we love coming to classrooms to speak to students and professors, especially if they're a journalism or media studies or poli-sci course, because the students' eyes light up, because to them, this makes sense. It doesn't feel new or strange or threatening to them. The current solutions being proposed are the ones that are threatening them and scaring them. Being able to see what your fellow news consumers think, that should just exist.
Well, and thanks to you and the folks at Tribeworthy, it does. And so we invite everybody to go see tribeworthy.com. Chase Palmieri, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show. I'm sure we'll have you up for updates in the future.
Looking forward to it.
Up next on the Project Censored Show, we are joined by the independent journalist, Dave Lindorf. We'll be talking about a recent article he wrote at thiscan'tbehappening.net. Washington is engaged in information warfare, including fake news and trolling, for years. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On this segment of the program, we are joined by veteran investigative journalist Dave Lindorf. Lindorf is the founder of thiscan'tbehappening.net. He is the author of four books. He's been a freelance writer for nearly 40 years. He writes for The Nation, Salon, London Review of Books, High Times, and other publications. Dave Lindorf has also graced the pages of our annual Project Censored volumes many, many times. And he also has been a guest right here at the Project Censored show. Dave Lindorf, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
You have a really great recent piece at your site, thiscan'tbehappening.net. And again, I love the tagline at your site, "This can't be happening, a major destabilizing influence."
We try.
Indeed, and you are doing a great job. Your recent article, late February, is Washington has engaged in information warfare, including fake news and trolling, for years. Now, why would we be writing about that? Why would we be talking about this issue right now, Dave Lindorf, in the midst of Russiagate?
There's this whole thing going on trying to blame the Democrats' colossal loss to Trump and the Republicans in November 2016 on the Russians rather than on themselves and their catastrophic, you know, candidate and their years of betraying their voters, catching up with them. But there's almost nothing there. The things I've read and the things that are in the Mueller indictment that try to show this kind of trolling, most of them are things that the rest of the U.S. media does, you know, buying ads to promote their news stories that are coming up. That's how you use social media, like RT TV, which I frequently am on. And, you know, full disclosure, I get paid $100 for my time when I go down to the video uplink studio to answer a question for them. I need to be paid for my time if I have to drive down there and, you know, talk for 5 minutes. By the time I do it, I've spent 2 hours. So they've agreed to send me $100. I say that as fair disclosure. And their news, frankly, I mean, people who complain about it should go to RT.com and look at the America one and just see what they think. It's like good American journalists working on it. And it's better news. They're the ones who were reporting on, say, Standing Rock before anybody in the mainstream media in the U.S. was covering it. It was just being, the violence was being ignored, but there it was in RT TV. You need that stuff. But the point is, why is this coming up? That everybody's in high dudgeon over the fact that Russia may have, and I have to say that because there's really, the evidence is very, very, very pathetic, that they've been trying to stir up trouble here through fake news or pushing things that are already tense between right and left in the U.S. and trying to get people angrier. It wouldn't surprise me if they were trying to do that, because that's what countries do to each other. But the real point is that Washington has been doing it big time, including to Russia, when they really interfered and maybe helped turn the election to Yeltsin for his reelection.
Going back to the 90s?
1996. And we'll see. The CIA director admitted that the U.S., since World War II, has interfered in at least 81 democratic elections around the world, trying to throw them one way. And he excused it by saying, well, you know, we were on the good side trying to prevent communists from taking over. You know, they interfered in the Italian elections, French elections after the war, Greek election, and they interfered in the Russian election, like I said. It's okay for us to do it. I mean, it's laughable for us to be saying the Russians interfered with our election when, if anything, if they did do it, it would be payback for what we did in 1996.
Right. During all of this sort of Russia hysteria at MSNBC with Rachel Maddow and of course many others, as you know, we have to remember that the initial claims were that Russia hacked the election, then they meddled in the election, now they're colluding. The baselines keep shifting. The goalposts keep moving.
That's because the evidence doesn't show up.
And furthermore, isn't it Les Moonves over at CBS that said that Trump was bad for America but damn good for CBS? And then the networks collectively gave somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 to $6 billion of coverage for this guy?
Yeah, free coverage.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
For ratings, yeah.
So these claims of fake news and so on are also interesting, because a lot of the claims aren't necessarily fake. They just go against establishment narratives.
Yeah, that's right. And the other thing is, of course, well, if, you know, we talked about this before about how alternative news is being called fake news and corporate news is being called real news. The other reason I wrote this article is that one of the complaints is that they have these trolls and these boiler rooms of trolls in St. Petersburg who are stirring up on Facebook and getting in debates and carrying people down with fake facts and stuff like that. And the reality is that we've got that too. The Pentagon has for years been paying people to be basically sock puppets with fake identities going on to sites. I remember Common Dreams, somebody at Common Dreams told me some years back during the Iraq war that they had found that they were being heavily hit with trolls on their comments pages, and they did an investigation. They hired someone to look at what was happening, and they found that a lot of the letter writers, unidentified letter writers, had ISPs of the Pentagon. When they told me that, they said, don't write about it because we're going to write an article about it, but I never saw it appear, but that's what I was told. I found myself bombarded after I did a piece for In These Times, and I write about it in this piece, and it ruined my relationship with In These Times. ITT handled it so badly. What happened was I wrote about depleted uranium weapons being used in Iraq, which they were used extensively. So I wrote about this, and I used some numbers about how much was used, which I'd gotten from European sources and also from an expert who was involved with it, Doug Rocky, a former Army captain who had conducted a Pentagon study on the safety of DU weapons, which he concluded they weren't safe, and then went on to direct a decontamination of sites in Kuwait after the Gulf War. He was one of my sources for how much they've used, and I was bitterly attacked by several people. One who I think attacked you guys, this guy, Jack Cohen Jope.
We got a lot of heat for that because in the mid-90s, Project Censored covered several of these kinds of stories, and one of them put the figure that since the Manhattan Project of World War II, numerous government studies have indicated DU weapons were effective, they were also toxic, et cetera, but one put in terms of the first Gulf War that the Army fired at least 14,000 rounds or 40 tons of DU ammunition. In other words, there are people saying that this wasn't happening at all, and you were being attacked, we're being attacked for that, but nevertheless, and that's something you're pointing out in your recent article, is that you're saying that you link, in fact, to seven different articles of stories, whether it's about DU or the Pentagon doing fake Al-Qaeda videos, etc. I mean, you're talking about how they're actively involved in manipulating information. In this case, you're talking about how you're actually reporting information for alternative press, right, that then in turn comes around and is accused of being fake news because it counters official narratives.
Yeah, but it's attacked by government-paid trolls from the U.S., not Russia, attacking legitimate news stories and trying to undermine them by lying. What they did is they went after Rocky and tried to claim that he was like a fraud, and they tried to say that my facts were wrong. And the result was that Joel Bleifuss, the editor at In These Times, even though I'd been a reporter for them since they were founded and I was on their masthead, he published a letter from this guy, Chope, tearing apart what I'd said, and he didn't give me a chance to respond. He just ran it. I found it one day when the paper came to my house, and they never do that in these times. They always give their writers a chance to reply to critical articles. So I complained bitterly, and he finally agreed to let me write a response. And then the schmuck wrote his own italicized editor's comment saying that he still didn't believe my article. And I just said, screw this. I'm off the masthead, guys. And I wrote a RIP article about In These Times that ran in Counterpunch. I said they'd lost their way and it's a dead magazine. It's laughable, but it's also tragic that the U.S. is using these sock puppets, paid sock puppets, to attack legitimate news in U.S. publications. It's horrible.
Well, Dave Lindorf, I mean, I'm even just looking right now on foreignpolicy.com. They have an article from a year ago talking about the U.S. using depleted uranium in Syria. The reason I bring that up is that the original critiques, I recall, with Project Censored, was that this was never happening at all.
Yeah, it was total fake news being propagated by people who, you know, I wonder about Chope because he bills himself as an anti-nuke person. He has this little website and he goes against nuclear weapons and nuclear power. But, you know, why his Ahab-like obsession with attacking depleted uranium weapons stories? It doesn't make any sense. So I'm assuming he's involved with this paid troll thing. More recently, there's this guy, Joel Harding, who was a high-ranking Army guy with the Cyber Command, who turns out to have been the one who reviewed an article I'd written in Counterpunch and called it appallingly pro-Russian propaganda and used that to argue that Counterpunch should be on Proper Not. And, you know, I traced him down and I even talked with him and I found out he worked at the Cyberspace Command in Fort Detrick outside of Washington, D.C., and that's what they do, this kind of crap. And he's affiliated with this group of hackers and fake newsmakers in Ukraine that have been doing a lot of this stuff.
Nafis Ahmed wrote several years ago, going back 3 years, an article, Pentagon makes no secret of wanting to monitor social change activism, the Minerva Research Initiative. This goes back to 2008 under Robert Gates. And this has been going on for quite a while. And in fact, just a few years ago, the Pentagon invested $8 million in projects from almost any academic discipline, which must, of course, be relevant to contemporary DOD strategic priorities. So the purpose is that they are looking, they're investing money to find people to basically bring on so that they can both monitor real time, counterattack, write their own propaganda, or as you said, troll, right? Go on your site and try to defame you and then flack from the propaganda model, contact people at the magazine and give them all kinds of grief because you're writing about these things. Instead of having you as the journalist be able to respond and an ombudsperson step in, so what happens is the pressure causes them to cave in, and then they kind of throw you under the bus.
Yeah, that's the result. It used to be done in the McCarthy and post-McCarthy era. It was more direct, like a friend of mine who was writing for the Riverside paper in California, and he had just gotten a job like a month before, and he was getting back on his feet, and he had been a former member of the Communist Party until 65. So he's working, and the FBI came while he was at work and went to his editor and said, you know, this guy's a communist, you should fire him. And they did. His editor told him, I'm sorry, we can't have you here if you're a communist. And he said, I'm not. And he said, well, yeah, but you were. So he got dumped. And that was the old way it went. You couldn't be a Red or a fellow traveler. But now it's they'll attack your credibility. They'll undermine you. And these days, you know, the jobs are so hard to keep that it just keeps everybody in line. And you wonder, why is the reporting so shabby? And why aren't reporters speaking up and stuff? And people are just careerists and they're afraid and they get intimidated or they think this will happen. There's not a lot of spine on the editor side. And the young journalists are caving.
We're speaking with independent journalist Dave Lindorf. His site is thiscan'tbehappening.net. We're talking about a recent article that Lindorf wrote, Washington has long engaged in information warfare, including fake news and trolling. I'm Mickey Huff. This is the Project Censored Show. After this musical break, we'll continue our conversation with independent journalist Dave Lindorf. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program today, we are speaking with a veteran investigative journalist and founder of ThisCan'tBeHappening.net, Dave Lindorf. He's the author of four books, has been a freelance writer for the past 38 years. He's written for The Nation, Salon, London Review of Books, High Times, and many, many more, and also has had many of his stories highlighted in Project Censored's annual books, published by Seven Stories Press. Dave Lindorf, before the break, we were talking about the influence that government can have on journalistic outlets to spike stories, to attack journalists. And now, in the age of weaponized fake news, it's been made even easier. We see a president now that wields the moniker of fake news at many of the corporate media outlets that seem to get caught up in his web and his narrative rather than actually critique his policies and off the corruption that is boiling beneath the surface. And just before we took that break, we were talking about the chilling effect that this has on journalists, people not wanting to be targeted. So clearly at your site, thiscan'tbehappening.net, you didn't get the chill and you didn't get the memo that there are things that you're not supposed to write about. So the folks that are in your collective continue to write about very serious and significant issues as a matter of course. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, we're kind of the opposite. We found out from the Partnership for Civil Justice, who did this huge Freedom of Information data grab from the FBI and Homeland Security when they were looking into what actually went on in the crushing of the Occupy movement. And they sent a memo that they found among the files that they got, which was sent out. I think we talked about this once. It warned 72 fusion centers about a little newspaper called This Can't Be Happening that had run an article exposing Homeland Security's role in coordinating the attack on all the Occupy movement sites. And they had this beautiful line that said, fortunately, this information's still compartmentalized in the alternative media, but we're alerting you in case it breaks into the mainstream media. And this came from something called the Office of Threat Assessment in Washington. So we put that on our masthead. That's another thing it says on the masthead. The only news organization, U.S. news organization, to be officially labeled a threat by Homeland Security.
So, Dave Lindorf, you have argued in your recent piece that this is not just a one-off. This isn't just a happenstance thing. This is a calculated, targeted effort. We know that the CIA has long meddled and tried to work with newsrooms. And in fact, John Kuryakow, who is the former CIA counterterrorism officer that blew the whistle on the CIA torture program, that then served 23 months in prison as a result to oppose the program and make the public aware of it. The people doing the torture served no time. He served 23 months of a prison sentence because of it. He has a recent piece titled, Why Does the CIA Prefer Corporate Media? And he kind of goes through, and he's talking about a very similar business, right? This is kind of like real fake news, right? CIA-backed, Pentagon-backed. And you, of course, highlight that in your recent article, and you give a list of different circumstances where the so-called deep state or Pentagon officials or others not only meddle in news relations, but actually manufacture stories. One of them is in our recent book. It's the Pentagon paid UK PR firm for fake Al-Qaeda videos. That's a pretty incredible story.
I remember that. There were these movies coming out, and people were saying, oh, my God, look at these horrible things, and it turns out that we were making them.
That was the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. That was from October of 2016, Fake News and False Flags, right? That was the title of the article.
Wasn't one of those actually cited as having instigated the attack on the embassy in Libya?
Yeah, I believe so.
One of their movies got everybody so ticked off that they attacked the embassy.
So interesting blowback from fake news, like real fake news blowback. And again, this article points out that the Pentagon paid a British PR firm more than $660 million.
That's a lot of money.
To run it. I mean, geez, just think what you could do with this. This can't be happening with a fraction of that money.
Oh, my God.
if they really think you're a propaganda program, they should pony up.
Yeah, right.
Well, they were running a top-secret propaganda program in Iraq from 2006 to 2011. The reason I'm pointing that out is this is like the DU story, like some of the other stories that you're bringing up. This is not something that happened yesterday. This is not happening since the popularization and weaponization of the term fake news. This is stuff that has been happening ritually as a matter of historic pattern for decades.
That's right. Look what they did to Webb.
Gary Webb from the
Dark Alliance thing. They ruined his life and drove him to suicide for telling the truth.
And, of course, they denied it. The CIA denied it. The San Jose Mercury News took Gary Webb's story and published it and then apparently were contacted and or influenced to stop supporting him, sack him from the paper. And the CIA initially denied it, but no one could really find any serious errors in Gary Webb's reporting. And then I know that he, through Project Censored, was introduced to Seven Stories, and eventually the Dark Alliance book was published on the CIA crack cocaine connection, wherein the CIA eventually claimed that, yes, they were doing it, but it wasn't really that big of a deal.
Yeah, except that they killed him.
They ruined his career, and then they also sparked some of the crack cocaine epidemic that was going on in South Central Los Angeles.
Right.
So it was far more than the no big deal in that case. So, Dave Lindorf, there's a few other things. And again, I'm reminding listeners to go to thiscan'tbehappening.net, and you can learn a lot more about what's happening with Dave Lindorf, and in particular this article. Dave Lindorf, let's go back to where we started with all of the things happening with the so-called Russiagate. We already mentioned the billions of dollars of free coverage Trump got, the $3 billion given to Clinton, a little less maybe to Bernie Sanders. Somehow, this kind of information, it just doesn't even come into context. Right here in the U.S., it's a multi-billion dollar business to try to sway people with propaganda.
Sure. There was a hit piece done by, I think it was 60 Minutes on RT, where even though they were doing a hit piece, the woman that was the head of it was quite articulate and managed to embarrass them pretty much. But looking at the story, you just say, this is an awful story. It doesn't make sense. But one of the points is that every network uses social media to promote their news stories and their programs. And that's what RT was doing.
This is what I'm trying to point out, is that there seems to be highly selective outrage.
Absolutely. And then on top of that, there's a lot of fake news that's deliberately promoted in the corporate media that they know that it's fake. They'll quote only official government sources to say that the Syrian government used gas attack in Ghouta. Great. Everybody knows that the White Helmets are a propaganda outfit. Nobody says that in the U.S. media when they report on these guys. It's like those are like the Red Cross, right? But they're not.
Dave Lindorf, in your recent article, you say we live in complicated times. It's not good enough any longer to just watch or read the news put out by once respected news sources. We know that they've become incredibly corrupted, you write, by their near monopoly status in most markets, their vulnerability to government pressure, and by reporters' loss of professionalism in the face of increasing job insecurity. So there's a lot going on here. What, in your assessment, is one of the most important things that we really can do?
I'll give you an example really quickly. I have a friend who's very active in the local Democratic Party, lifelong Democrat, really dedicated guy. We were talking and he was saying, isn't it true that Russia invaded Crimea? And I said, no, it's not. They didn't invade Crimea. They had 20,000 troops there by agreement with Ukraine. And they never brought troops in. They were just there. And he said, didn't Assad gas all these people? And what are we going to do about that? And I said, but he didn't. It's pretty clear that it's by ISIS that caused an incident and get the U.S. to come in. And he said, but I read this in every paper. They're all saying that. And I said, look, you have to look for other sources of information because these organizations are basically doing government propaganda. And he said, well, where can I look? And I said, well, you go online. You can read The Guardian in England, much better newspaper than the New York Times or the Washington Post. They have their own problems, but it gives you another perspective. And then there's really good alternative news sources in the U.S., Truth Out, Common Dreams, This Can't Be Happening. Most liberals go and look at HuffPost, which is not really that alternative. But there are much better places. Truth Dig, for God's sake. That's great. And Consortium News. And there's one other thing that they need to do. You got to support alternative media, because this stuff doesn't happen for free. People need to go to places that are doing this good, important work of getting real news out and give it something. Give it $5.
I hear what you're saying, Dave Lindorf. You have done almost four decades of stellar work of investigative journalism, and your site is thiscan'tbehappening.net. Certainly encourage listeners to go there and read some of the great journalism that comes out of your site with your collective. And thank you once again for coming back on the Project Censored Show.
Well, thank you for having me on.
We want land supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Thank you for tuning in to the Project Censored Show, which airs on your...
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
This archival recording is part of a tribute to Michael Parenti, the internationally known political scientist, historian, and activist.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, the JFK assassination and the gangster nature of the state. When Oliver Stone's movie JFK opened in December 1991, a huge PR campaign was mobilized against the film. Even progressives spoke out. Noam Chomsky wrote in support of the Warren Commission's findings. In contrast, Michael Parenti gave one of his highly acclaimed talks criticizing the lone assassin theory. The bitter question that haunted defenders and critics alike was whether government agencies of a democratic country would do such a thing as assassinate an elected president. In the talk that you're about to hear, Michael Parenti turns to that question first. He examines what he calls the gangster nature of the state. He spoke in Berkeley on the 30th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Michael Parenti.
I've been looking at history, and I've been impressed and depressed by the fact that history is really a chronicle of immense atrocities. What we have in history is the fact that when surplus value develops, when there's more than a subsistence economy, you have some portion of the population that will do everything it can to enslave and to expropriate the labor of the rest of the people, whether it's a slave society, as in ancient Greece and Rome, or feudal society where people were reduced to serfs, or in a capitalist society where people are driven to the edge of insecurity and made to work faster and harder. And one of the things that's used in that arrangement is a very conscious instrument of control that's very necessary. And that instrument is called the state. That is, what they do is set up a state, an organization that has as Max Weber, who wasn't a Marxist, as Max Weber called it, an organization that has a monopoly on the legitimate uses of force and violence, on the use of legitimate force and violence. But that's what we have today. We also have developed in modern times some democratic features, some means of trying to fight back and restrain this arbitrary power. What am I trying to say? That along with government, we also have a thing called the state. And along with governance, along with policies, and along with those things, we have this other instrument, even in a democratic state. And that instrument, whether it's in democratic France, or democratic England, or democratic Germany, or democratic Italy, or democratic USA, or democratic Canada, and all these countries, all of them have these other instruments and agencies that act like a bunch of gangsters, that act repressively, that use surveillance, that use every dirty trick in the book, unequal enforcement of tax laws, name it. The bringing in of drugs into whole neighborhoods and communities, trumped up murder charges, assassination. And that you have in the middle of these democracies, you have the state within the state known as the national security state. And that state is capable of the most unspeakable crimes that you can think of. And those crimes are perpetrated against their own people. They're perpetrated against people all around the world. Not long ago, I got a letter from a woman who's been a community organizer in Chicago. And she said with grief in her heart, she said, I remember the 60s. I remember the tremendous democratic organization and leadership that was developing in the Latino and African-American communities. And I remember those leaders, and every single one of them today is either dead, shot by the police, or in Marion prison on trumped up charges. And I remember the demoralization that took place, the shattering of those organizations. And after those organizations were shattered and demoralized, then in came the drug traffickers. And those drug traffickers, the thing I remember the most about them is that they were aided and abetted by the feds, by the federal agents themselves. And this is what happens. That is, we are dealing with a state that was engaged in domestic counterinsurgency, and it was more interested in having a population that was unorganized and demoralized than a population that was organized, that was effectively fighting for its democratic rights. Because if it's organized and it's effective and it's powerful, it will start making demands and start pursuing its interests, and it will start cutting in on the interests that those police and those coppers and those undercover people and those forces of military and law and order are dedicated to protecting the status quo, protecting those with property against those who don't have it. And by the way, for the last 1,000 years, we've had theorists who've made that point, except they make it proudly. Adam Smith said, as the divisions of property become increasingly unequal, it is more and more necessary to have a state to defend those who have property from those who do not. John Locke, the purpose of the state is to defend those who have property from those who do not. James Harrington. You can go on. James Madison. Alexander Hamilton. The only difference was that when Marx said it, he said to defend those who have property from those whose labor is expropriated by those who accumulate wealth off their labor, who have all the property. He changed it a little bit. And he said it wasn't just haves and have-nots. It was haves taking it from those who produced it and created the haves. And throughout the world, dominant economic interests today have enlisted the efforts of assassins and torturers. As we talk at this moment, the CIA and other such agencies in this country and other countries have sponsored violence, torture, death squads, drugs in scores of countries, from Zaire to Angola to Mozambique to El Salvador to Guatemala to Indonesia to East Timor, and you go on and on and on, all to Western Europe, to the USA, to Chicago and Detroit and Boston and New York. They have systematically targeted in many countries the clergy, the peasant leaders, intellectuals, journalists, student leaders, labor union leaders, workers, and any community activists and such. Tens of thousands have been murdered and assassinated to prevent social change, to destroy any kind of redistributive politics, any kind of government, any kind of social movement that is not willing to reduce its people to economic fodder. And with NAFTA, with the North American Free Trade Agreement, we now see the third worldization of the USA will continue full speed ahead. The gangster nature of the state is cloaked by the democratic facade and by the democratic substance of the government. I mean, there is some democratic substance there. Democratic victories have been won. We have struggled, and certain things have been won. And yet, in the midst of this, the state still goes on. And what is so compelling about an issue like drugs, as Michael Levine is pointing out, is that it's not that we're saying the government is not doing enough about drugs, or they were losing the war against drugs. It's that the government or elements in it are active perpetrators and purveyors of drugs. And what it is so compelling about the JFK assassination is how nakedly the gangster nature of the state is revealed. It is an awakening. And to know the truth about the JFK assassination is to create a delegitimating force that calls into question the entire state system and the entire social order it represents. And this is why, for 30 years, the mainstream press has suppressed or dismissed out of hand the findings about JFK's death, the findings of independent investigators like Peter Dale Scott, Harold Weisberg, Carl Oglesby, Mark Lane, Anthony Summers, Philip Melanson, Jim Garrison, Cyril Wecht, and dozens of others. They're called assassination buffs. They're not buffs. Even that word is a limiting and marginalizing and diminishing term. A buff is a kind of a hobby pursuer, you see. It's a kind of a quirky person who follows quirky little interests. Would you talk about Holocaust buffs, would you? No. They are serious investigators of a very serious crime, which leads to all sorts of serious understandings about the criminal nature of the state. And this is why they relentlessly, the mainstream media and the opinion leaders and the political leaders of this country, relentlessly attack or ignore this literature. And this is why they give fulsome, gushing, ready publicity to the likes of Gerald Posner with his book Case Closed, which got put into every major magazine. I couldn't put the TV on all week without seeing this guy's face and hearing him blather these kind of cliche statements whose credibility are dependent on you being totally ignorant of what the investigators for 30 years have been uncovering and the questions that have been raising, and who did a grotesque, idiotic whitewash of the whole thing. And this is why they savaged Oliver Stone's movie JFK, a movie that was very accurate about the specifics of the murder, a movie that reached millions of people, that broke through that thing that they were keeping down. The only movie in the history of Hollywood, and I wrote a book called Make Believe Media, which is about TV and film, so I think I know something about films. At least I did spend the better part of a year reading a lot of literature. It's the only movie that I know of that was attacked 6 months before it was ever released. In the Washington Post and in the New York Times and in Time and Newsweek, and attacked relentlessly for a year after it was released. And this is also why in this past week they kept up the relentless propaganda campaign with the 30th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination to show that Oswald was the lone assassin. And they're always limiting the question, just as the Warren Commission did a priori, was Oswald the lone assassin? Did he act alone? Did he or did he not act alone? Meanwhile, all the serious investigators have a different question. It's not that. He was not at all one of the people who shot Kennedy. He did not act at all, although he was involved in another way. He was involved as a fall guy. And this is why they do this. If you want to know why, you just listen to them. It's not my analysis. It's what they say. The propagandists of the right and the center know why they've got to trash this issue and contain it. Listen to what Tom Wicker of the New York Times had to say. Now, Tom Wicker, he's never written a movie review in his life. JFK came out, and Tom Wicker, who was a columnist, a Washington columnist for the New York Times, suddenly became a movie reviewer. And instead of getting the usual movie review length of 800 words, he got 2,000 words. It's a whole page with pictures and all that. And in that review, he tells us that if the, quote, wild assertions in Oliver Stone's movie are taken at face value, Americans will have to accept the idea that most of the nation's major institutions conspired together and carried out Kennedy's murder. In an era, Wicker goes on, in an era when mistrust of government and loss of confidence in institutions, the press not the least, are widespread and virulent, such a suggestion seems a dubious public service. So truth or not truth has nothing to do with it. He's saying the question is institutional legitimacy. Wicker understands the heart of the matter. A full revelation about the murder would be a serious attack upon the legitimacy of the dominant institutions of state and class, the press not being the least of one of those institutions, a faithful servant of it. The system that New York Times writers faithfully defend. Playing before mass audiences, the movie JFK did not finger a cabal of malevolent perpetrators, but in fact pointed the finger at the national security state itself as the murderer. Damage control. You know, back in 1978, the House Select Committee reported, in fact, after an investigation, that there was more than one assassin shooting Kennedy. And there, therefore, was a conspiracy. In response, the Washington Post immediately editorialized in 1978, quote, "Could it have been some other malcontent whom Mr. Oswald met casually?" It gets better. "Could not as many as three or four societal outcasts with no ties to any one organization have developed in some spontaneous way a common determination to express their alienation in the killing of President Kennedy? It is possible that two persons acting independently attempted to shoot the president at the very same time. It is possible. It's not at all likely." So sometimes those who deny conspiracies create the most convoluted fantasies of all. David Garrow, who wrote a biography of Martin Luther King, benignly, patronizingly looks at you, at the public mind, and he says that the evidence pointing to a conspiracy to murder Martin Luther King, a large majority of the American people do believe in assassination conspiracies. That allows events to have large, mysterious causes instead of small, idiosyncratic ones. I would say the Washington Post had the most mysterious cause of all a few minutes ago. They like that. They like the large causes. You see, but the question of conspiracy, it has to be decided by an investigation of evidence, not by a priori unscientific and patronizing presumptions about the public mind. In any case, the evidence in King's assassination doesn't involve large mysterious causes, but very immediate actualities. And the investigators, like Peter Dale Scott and Harold Weisberger and Mark Lane, they weren't impelled by some yearnings, you see. They were impelled by questions of evidence, by things that didn't just seem to make sense, by very immediate empirical things which drew them into this more and more. But which these people who never read that evidence don't have to deal with, and so they can fashion all these theories. The independent investigators demolished the Warren Commission. The first and most effective, perhaps, was Harold Weisberg's book, Whitewash, and then the other one by Mark Lane, Rush to Judgment. Right there, terrific, written 25 years ago. Let's focus on a small part of the actual conspiracy. I can't obviously go through it all. It would take ages. Let's start with Oswald. If you watch television this week, you again, for the 78th time, heard that Oswald was a loner, an incompetent, not very bright. You heard he was emotionally disturbed. Gerald Posner got on there, turning instant psychiatrist, and he said, Lee Harvey Oswald was a very disturbed young boy. He had a very disturbed childhood, and he was a passive aggressive. I said, a passive aggressive? A passive aggressive assassin? How does that... That explains why he used a rifle which couldn't shoot straight. He also was a leftist. Alexander Coburn has joined the right and the center, and in a column in the Examiner said he was a leftist. The truth is something else. Lee Harvey Oswald, all his IQ tests show that he was above average intelligence. He was a bright guy, a quick learner. Lee Harvey Oswald spent most of his adult life not as a lonely drifter, but directly linked to the U.S. intelligence community. At the age of 18 in the U.S. Marines, he had secret security clearance, and he was working at Marine Air Control in Atsugi Base in Japan. Atsugi was a top secret base where the CIA launched some of its U-2 flights and did other kinds of covert operations in China. The next year, at the age of 19, he was assigned to El Toro Air Station in California with security clearance to work radar. And here he emerged, certain strange things began to happen. He emerged as a babbling Russophile and Soviet communist. He started playing Russian language records at blast level in his barracks. He started addressing his fellow Marines in Russian. He read Russian books and touted Soviet communism as, quote, the best system in the world. He called his fellow Marines comrades. Now, the U.S. Marine Corps in 1958 was not exactly known as a bastion of liberal tolerance and free thinking. My buddy Bernard Livingston wrote a book called Closet Red. He tells of his experiences in the Army where they had to filter out anybody who had funny opinions, who had pinko-ish opinions or whatever else. They had to be reported. That the Army constantly, and I'm sure the Marines, constantly surveils anybody who might outspokenly or actively begin to say or act certainly in the way he did. But in this instance, Oswald's Marine commanders didn't mind. He kept his security clearance. He kept all the radar records. He could see what was going in and out and knew all about the things that were happening there. And he, a wealth of sensitive radar information and other highly sensitive information from sensitive bases, black operations as they were called. Well, if Oswald was a Soviet spy or a Cuban spy, as some people now claim, he certainly had a novel way of building a cover. Other odd things began happening. In February 1959, Lee Harvey Oswald failed the Marine Corps proficiency test in Russian. 6 months later, he was practically fluent in Russian. Only in 1974, a document that was dislodged from the Warren Commission that had been secreted thanks to Howard Weisberg's legal efforts got the document out. It was shown that Oswald had attended the U.S. Army Monterey School of Languages. Now, Monterey is not open to anyone who just happens to have a hobby, a language hobby. You go only for serious training, and you are sent by the government, and it must be related to government work in a language picked by the government, which is related to specific assignments. So Oswald learned Russian at the U.S. Monterey School of Languages. Another odd thing, Oswald was given an early discharge from the Marines because his mother had injured her foot. That's called a dependency discharge. Your parent needs you. A jar had fallen on her toe. And he was immediately, he put in the request and he got it within a week. His fellow Marines were astonished at the velocity of the release. It also so happened that the jar fell on her foot a year before the discharge. But she was having, it wasn't healing right, you know. This was only one of a number of very strangely favorable treatments that the U.S. government began to give Lee Harvey Oswald. He then defected to the USSR. But how? Philip Melanson raises the question. To get to Russia in those days, it would have cost $1,500. Lee Harvey Oswald's bank account showed a deposit of only $203. He got, after he arrived in London and was there, he left London and went to Helsinki on October 11th. On a day when there were no available commercial flights that would have allowed him to make it in one day. He had some kind of private transportation to get to Helsinki. In Russia, he announced that he was renouncing his U.S. citizenship and that he had lots of secrets that he was going to give to the Soviets. He even went into the U.S. embassy and announced that and made sure they all knew it. The Soviets didn't bite. They let him stay, but they at no time thought he could be an agent of any use to them. They kept him under constant surveillance. He worked in a factory. He showed no particular interest in guns, but he belonged to the factory's gun club. He used to join in the rabbit shoots, and he could never hit the rabbit. Always someone had to come behind him and shoot the rabbit while he was firing. Otherwise, they would have been there all day. It was a joke. He was a miserable marksman, as he had been in the U.S. Marines. He had been flagged again and again. He missed the whole target a number of times. You get the flag. So Lee Harvey Oswald's show was couldn't hit the side of a barn. Now, if Lee Harvey Oswald was really a defector and not a U.S. spy, then U.S. intelligence could well have taken the view that his was one of the most damaging defections in history. Now, what's done in all defections, especially those connected with government and military, is that there's a damage assessment. No damage assessment was ever made on Oswald's defection. This did come out in the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee. Why was there was no damage assessment? Guess it was just overlooked. We don't know. After 2.5 years, he applies to return to the U.S. This is after renouncing his citizenship, announcing he was going to give away secrets. And instead of being grabbed when he comes out and tried as a traitor, the U.S. accepts him back. And he says he was never debriefed. In fact, he was debriefed in Harlem. In Amsterdam, but the CIA has no record of debriefing him, doesn't know who he is, never touched him, was never near him. And their explanation before the commission was that there were so many tourists coming in and out, that there was nothing particularly about him that would catch our attention. One might wonder, what is needed to catch your attention? A defector, secrets, all that. After the assassination, the CIA claimed that they suspected that he was a Soviet spy. They still didn't debrief him then. That makes it even more curious. He gets out of Russia, and what does the State Department do? They give him money. They give him money to travel back to the U.S. and get set up. They pay all his travel and moving expenses and those of his wife's. He's given back his passport with full rights to travel anywhere and denounce the U.S. government again someplace else. His wife is exempted from usual immigration quotas. No waiting. No exclusion for having belonged to the Soviet Komsomol, which is the Communist Youth Organization, which is a violation of U.S. immigration laws, yet she was allowed in. Once back in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald settles in under the wing of one George Demorenschild, a right-wing Russian with CIA ties. And this begins a whole pattern that goes on in Dallas and New Orleans, namely forays out into the public eye as a leftist.
You heard part one of a one-hour talk by Michael Parenti entitled The JFK Assassination and the Gangster Nature of the State. In his book, Dirty Truths, Parenti gives more details about George Demorenschild. He was part of a network of Russian exiles contracted by the CIA. Demorenschild was also an associate of oil millionaires H.L. Hunt and Clint Murchison, and there exists a correspondence between George Pappy Bush and Demorenschild. The Warren Commission identified him as the person closest to Lee Harvey Oswald before the assassination. Demorenschild died by a gun blast to the head 3 hours after a House Assassinations Committee investigator tried to contact him. Over the objections of Demorenschild's daughter, his death was ruled a suicide. Come back for part two of this program when TUC Radio returns. Michael Parenti is one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts. He has taught at colleges and universities in the United States and abroad. With roots in a working-class Italian district of New York and a PhD in political science from Yale, Michael Parenti has become an internationally known lecturer. An extended text of this talk can be found in Parenti's book, Dirty Truth, published by City Lights. Visit TUC Radio's website at tucradio.org for links to Michael Parenti's website. Please find a pen to write down a phone number to call and find out how to order the one-hour CD of Michael Parenti, The JFK Assassination, and the Gangster Nature of the State. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order an audio CD of Michael Parenti's The JFK Assassination by calling 1-707-463-2654. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. You can get your CD by mail or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening.
Listen to Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
In the media and in the policy, has been, you know, liberal feminism. And I think that in many cases, what women object to is, in fact, exactly this kind of feminism, which basically has seen equality with men as the fundamental goal, and ignoring, for instance, that men, too, are exploited in this society. And, you know, has seen the as exclusive goal entering into the male-dominated areas.
That was the voice of author and educator Dr. Sylvia Federici, speaking with Sylvia about her newest book, Revolution at Point Zero. So stay tuned.
You are listening to Latin Waves. We are very privileged this morning to be joined by Sylvia Federici. She is the author of Revolution at Point Zero, Housework, Reproduction, and Feminist Struggle. Very privileged to have you on our program. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Sylvia, for inviting me.
Now, when we think about revolutions, you know, there's often the idea of armed revolution, of uprisings, and we often, you know, don't think about the specifics of what it is we're trying to revolutionize or change. So tell us a little bit about your book. How was this book inspired? But particularly its focus on housework and reproduction.
Yes, The Revolution at Point Zero, it's a book that collects many writings I've done over a period of almost 30 years, you know, from the times I was very engaged organizationally in the women's movement to the present. And it tries to provide a framework to think through, you know, what is domestic work and what is reproductive work as a whole, what place it has in society and in our life, in our experience, why it has been made so invisible and devalued. And also the book looks at the transformation that have taken place since the 80s and through the 90s in the restructuring of the global economy, and tries to see how these changes have transformed reproductive work and what impact these changes have had on women who have been and continue to be to this day the main subject of reproductive work. It's still women who do most of the housework and most of the domestic work also outside of the home on a paid basis. So this is what the book presents in, and, you know, some of the earliest essays are from the 1970s when I was involved in an organization called Wages for Housework, the International Campaign for Wages for Housework. You know, our position, I think, revolutionized, truly revolutionized the way housework has been conceived traditionally, because it has always been presented as a work of love, as a personal service that women do to their family, to their children, their husbands, and in a way as something natural, you know, something that belongs or issues from the personality, the physical and psychological makeup of women. And we were fighting against this idea, which has been so important, you know, so effective in making this work invisible, making invisible that it is work. It is social work as much as any other form of work. And in a way, we turned the tables around. We said, you know, housework, domestic work, the whole range of reproductive activities that mostly women, not only women, but mostly women have done and do in the home, have been the work that has not only reproduced our life, but has also reproduced the workforce and have reproduced people's capacity to go to work on a day-to-day basis. So far from being unimportant, actually this work has been the pillar, you know, the foundation for every other form of work. They have been really the foundation for, you know, the capitalist organization of work. And we have denounced the fact that, you know, employers have gotten away with a lot of free labor because, you know, without, you know, a person at home, you know, reproducing, you know, workers on a day-to-day basis, reproducing wage workers, every place of employment would shut down. So we really changed the term of the debate, and that in itself, I think, has been a revolution, certainly has raised the consciousness of the social importance of this work, and has raised the consciousness that we live in a society that in a way is committed to the devaluation of this work, is committed to make this work invisible.
I'm so glad that you raised that. You know, when we think of reproduction, we don't think about, you know, the caring capacity that reproduction requires and who provides that. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the way feminism, you know, as a movement has become both, for many women, almost an irritant. You know, I was reading recently a journal, and the woman said, "I identify myself as a womanist, not as a feminist, because feminist is men versus women, and womanist is all people, you know, to eradicate, you know, economic violence against women." And I thought for a second, interesting. And so can we unpack a little bit how how we could do our revolution in ways that it's more inclusive and accessible to people, because I find that there is a divide between what feminism in the West means to people who do not take race and class into consideration, and what the idea of, you know, this perhaps alternative form of feminism, in my opinion, this womanist view of uniting both men and women in the defense of creating a society with equity, how the two could converge, and how the two could find some common ground in this idea of the sexual division of labor, on the, you know, the ways in which capitalism has naturalized inequality and exploitation as ways of being.
First of all, I guess that the first thing to clarify is that although feminism is a general umbrella, there are actually very different types of feminism. For instance, within the women's movement at its beginning as well, after a short phase of seeming unity, you know, you had different political positions, and unfortunately, the one that got more prominence in the media and in the policy has been, you know, liberal feminism. And I think that in many cases, what women object to is, in fact, exactly this kind of feminism, which basically has seen equality with men as as the fundamental goal, and ignoring, for instance, that men too are exploited in this society, and you know, as seen the as exclusive goal entering into the male-dominated areas, you know, and not ignoring, and for example, having access to wage labor, ignoring, for instance, that black women and women from other ethnic groups that have been discriminated have always had to have a wage work, because their husband never had the protection of a wage that white male workers had. And so this very narrow, and, you know, so, and also the fact that liberal feminists never placed the question of reproductive work, its devaluation, and the devaluation of women's work, never placed it within a broader context, you know, a context that takes into account that we are in an exploitative society, we are in a capitalist society, and unless those relationships are also transformed, you know, it's not possible for women to receive any justice. The kind of politics that now is defined as politics of gender, you know, where gender is now an absolute term, not really contextualized, you know, within why in this particular society, why in this social system, you know, we have this type of organization of housework, this type of organization of productive work. This is certainly one factor that I think alienates a lot of women. Also, there is the impression, and my view is that this has been promoted very much by the press, you know, that feminism, it's a struggle against men. I, in my long experience, you know, being in the women's movement and studying the women's movement, I never, very few women actually took that position, that men are the problem. Even if sometimes that was said, you know, because there was, in the impetus of the women's movement when it first established itself, you know, many times women found that the first people they had to struggle against was their husband or father, because, for instance, you wanted to go to a meeting and they wouldn't allow you to go out at night, or they would be very upset that you be with other women and not pay all the time, you know, attention to them. But I don't see in the history of the different feminism across the world that actually women have targeted men as the enemy. They have targeted inequality. They have targeted subordination. They have targeted economic dependence. So I appreciate women who say I'm a womanist, but I'm not sure that it really resolves the issue. I think, again, one of the problems of feminism is that feminism has been very much, you know, domesticated, that the kind of broad social transformation that in the early part of the movement, at least in the United States, in Europe, the broad social transformation that many women intuited as necessary, you know, not only in the condition of women, but the society as a whole had to be changed. That was lost, you know, and then feminism was taken on, you know, by the United Nations government and domesticated, redefined in a way that could actually support a neoliberal agenda. In my view, this is the problem, you know, with feminism, and particularly, as I said, liberal feminism, which has now been taken by the media and by the international power structure as to be what the feminist movement is about. And this is definitely a problem, because it leaves out a whole problematic that has to do with international political economy, has to do with the dispossession of millions of people at the hands of, you know, the corporation. It has a way with the forms of the exploitation of labor in so many different ways, and with the impoverishment that international policies are creating, the destruction of the environment, and the new forms of racism that are, you know, daily being constructed. So I think that in this sense, the dissatisfaction with feminism is genuine. But I would say that this is a kind of institutionalized feminism that is being produced, you know, through the many global conferences organized by the UN, you know, and has been introduced starting with the late 70s, but does not represent, you know, all the feminist movement that today exists in the world. Again, I think we need to really distinguish. Otherwise, we risk to accept the media portrait of what feminism is.
One of the struggles that I think we've collectively faced, men, women, you know, of all classes, is climate change. It's also a struggle to remember that we are part of the land, that we are actually not separate, but part of it. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit, because we live in a world where 80% of all the refugees are women and children.
Yes.
And so the attack on Mother Nature naturalizes, it seems to me, the violence on women and the erosion of productive rights.
You know, the disaster that we have witnessed in the last few days in the Philippines, you know, is a very direct consequence of these devastating policies, because there's a general agreement, for instance, that these incredible winds that shaped that hurricane are a consequence of the warming of the oceans. And the warming of the ocean, of course, are a consequence of the really criminal blindness and criminal refusal, you know, to change form of production, you know, which is in fact destroying the environment. And it's not only climate change in general, but wherever you go, from the furthest of Africa to Latin America to the U.S., you find exactly the same problem. You find the mining companies now are expropriating, are massively expropriating in violent and fraudulent ways, often with the complicity of local chiefs, governments, and so on, people, and then squeeze this land, you know, squeeze this land to take anything out. And whether it is gold or diamond or platinum or oil, you have fracking that is destroying so many in the U.S. as well, you know, thousands of kilometers in so many countries. so many places you have the same struggle today, whether it is Canada, whether it is, for example, the case of New Brunswick, like recently, where you have a whole indigenous population fighting against the attempt to, for the mining company to come and do fracking in their territory, you know, who have come and confronted the police, and they've been beaten, they've been arrested. This just a few weeks ago, in fact, that struggle is still continuing to this day. And not only the land, but the seas and the forests, you know. So we are moving towards a world where people have been made, you know, homeless, refugees, you know, forced more and more into refugee camps or into these mega cities, 20 million people, you know. I think the idea of this corporation, the Monsanto and the mining companies, because there is a real continuity between the politics of agrofuel, agrobusiness, and mining. Basically, the idea of pushing the people of the world into mega cities and then have complete control over the natural resources of the planet. This, I think, is the scenario, the landscape that is unfolding, and all we can hope is that people's resistance will be able to put a stop to it, will be able to reverse it.
The other part, I think, is that we need to maybe explore how we go about resistance, because if the resistance of workers in the Philippines and the resistance of workers in Canada and the U.S. were aligned, we would have very different response. You know, the Monsanto companies would not be able to simply move with impunity. If, you know, if our struggles yes. were aligned, we would not have to debate whether women's work in the home should be shared work, should be, you know, acknowledged as labor. You know, we would have at least a conversation, you know, and yes. have the spaces to have.
Yeah, I think it's very, very important. For instance, as an example, this summer, I was in Greece, I was in Thessaloniki, and some friends drove me up to this area, Alkiri, which is in the north of Greece. It's a beautiful, beautiful area, it's a little paradise. It is near one of the oldest forests in Europe. The sea is marvelous, and there are all kinds of beautiful old villages. And right there, a Canadian company from Vancouver, its headquarters are based in Vancouver, it's called El Dorado. And I know because I did some research, so I know it's in Vancouver. It's basically planning this incredible project, which is an open mine extraction of gold, which means that the construction of a huge, huge hole that would be filled with all kinds of cyanide or mercury to detach the gold from the ore. Already they have begun logging from this very ancient forest. So presumably the forest will be destroyed at the end of the process. Actually, the process does not have an end in sight. The gold in the terrain is very small. So in order to dig the gold, they have to move a huge amount of soil, and that will create a permanent cloud in the sky. So the villagers around have been protesting. They've been really also, unfortunately, this company, El Dorado, has the support of the government, and the government sends the police. When we drove up to the village, we saw, you know, a police truck stationed almost close to the entrance of the village. And, of course, the connection, if people from Greece could be connected with people who are against this type of practices in Vancouver.
I wonder if we could talk about the alternatives, because in many ways, we were talking about creating a new commons, you know, a commons of sharing, not just knowledge, but also resources.
Absolutely. You know, a number of things I think is very important to realize that even now, with that immense drive to, you know, take over all the land by the corporation, nevertheless, you still have many population in the world. I think Latin America is a good example, who still have the land, who still own land in common, and still manage the land on a community base, on a communitarian base. It's very important to know, because many times when we speak of sharing the resources of the earth, you know, people have been so individualized, and people have been often so, in a sense, convinced that capitalism is the only way, and the notion of private property, that this is the, and competition, you know, in the labor market. These ideas have become, for many, a kind of second nature. It's important to know, actually, that not only historically, you know, people organize their life in a communitarian base, but even today that exists. So those commons are very much under attack. I want to conclude our discussion by going back to the theme of revolution, because a revolutionary productive work, you know, revolution at point zero, which is the moment of the production, because I think it's there that we have to begin to change our world, you know, our relationship. We certainly have to create a world that is based on a very different logic than the capitalist logic. We have to build a world that is based on cooperation and is built not on the exploitation of other human beings, and is not built on the exploitation of the natural world, you know, because this is a world that can only promise poverty, war, and different forms of racism. And already we see how destructive it is of the planet and human life. So the alternative today for many people is encapsulated in the idea of the commons. And in my view, we begin to build the commons not only defending, you know, those spaces and those natural resources that are all around us and now are being privatized. You know, so we need to build a movement and coalition between people who are struggling around ecology, feminists, and many other social movements to defend those spaces. But we also have to transform the everyday life. We have to transform our homes of reproduction, which has been organized in a way that divides us, you know. It's been organized in a way that really individualizes and atomizes our lives. And, you know, this is not, it's a way that makes us feel more powerless, more alone. Mm-hmm. So I'm very interested, in fact, of rethinking the home, you know, rethinking the relationship between the home and the community, and seeing how we can, in fact, begin to transform our life, starting from, you know, our relationship in the family, but also the whole social architecture of the home and the way reproductive work is performed. So we need, in fact, to, as part of our struggle, and even as a base from which to begin to reclaim the resources that are taken away from us, you know, but we need to really create a new social fabric. And I think that that's the kind of revolution that we need to begin, you know, in our own life, you know, starting from our home.
As I was listening to you, I thought, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if this society also included, you know, the right to leisure, the right to imagine ourselves, you know, enjoying.
Right, because it's work. You know, there are no women. Women are, in the United States, they are the main consumer of antidepressants. Depression is today a national disease. They say we live longer, but how do we live?
thank you so much for being with us today. What inspires you? What inspires you to get up every morning and mobilize and organize and continue to do work that many people see as an uphill struggle?
You know, what inspires me is the fact that no matter how bad things appear and are hopeless, children are still born and they are going to pose questions of us. You know, I remember myself as a child. I used to pester my mother and say, you know, why was I born during the war? You know, I think of the new children, the new generation who are expecting to have a life.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Dr. Sylvia Federici. She is the author of Revolution at Ground Zero. Tell our audience how they can access your book.
Distributed by PM Press, or I'm sure also Amazon.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.